Welcome to a special clinical investigator think tank on systemic treatment of prostate cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. We gathered seven researchers in the field to discuss and debate recent trial findings and clinical implications. And on researchtopractice.com, you'll find a series of short PowerPoint lectures from the faculty on a variety of topics discussed. To begin, Dr. Steve Friedland presents a patient from his practice who exemplifies the clinical challenges of one of the most controversial areas in prostate cancer, management of patients with PSA-only relapse.
So this is a young 54-year-old man, relatively healthy, he's obese. His PSA was 5, and a year ago it was 2.1, so he's kind of rapidly rising PSA. Had a biopsy, 12 core, T1C, Gleason 3 plus 4 and 4 cores. Being young with kind of intermediate risk disease, goes on to radical prostatectomy and was found to actually have positive seminal vesicles, positive margins, Gleason 4 plus 3. He kind of did our standard node dissection, which is not super extensive, and that was negative. And I guess, you know, the first question is always adjuvant radiation or not at that point. This was a while ago, kind of before we fully appreciated things. I think I've become a little bit more aggressive, particularly for the young seminal vesicle. But his initial PSA was undetectable, which kind of gave us a little bit more confidence. His continence took a little bit longer to come back. Sometimes we see that in obese men. So he was observed. And at 12 months, his PSA remained undetectable, but started to rise. At 12 months, it was 0.2. At 15 months, it was 0.4. He did get a bone scan, which was negative, as you would expect. And we talked about radiation, and you know, I'd love to hear kind of Howard's thoughts as to what, how, hormones or not. Ultimately, he was lost to follow-up.
So how would you have thought through his situation at that point, Howard, with a PSA of 0.4 at 15 months?
And he had indications for radiation at the time of surgery, at least what we would say today would be reasonable indications. And I think he should get radiation therapy at the present time. It's a curative modality. The guy has potentially curative disease still since he has no known metastatic disease. And radiation's the only thing that can render him totally disease-free with the potential for tumor eradication. And the morbidity of radiation in the salvage setting is quite modest.
If he were to say to you, or someone in this situation were to say to you, what would the chance be that I'll never have another problem, a PSA will never go up again if I get radiation therapy?
I usually am relatively conservative, and for a person like this, I would give them a roughly 50% chance of long-term disease-free status with radiation. As long as his PSA is 0.4, I think that's a reasonable estimate.
And Judd, would you agree with the thought that most likely the radiation therapy is not going to be a major issue in terms of side effects or complications, or what would you talk to him about?
No, my sense is that, you know, in the modern era of better radiation control, that number one, at 0.4, I would be fairly certain that the PSA rise does represent prostate cancer and not benign PSA from sometimes benign tissue left behind. And plus, Steve mentioned that he did have fairly high-risk features. So I feel fairly confident that if we do refer him for radiotherapy, that we're radiating prostate cancer. I would counsel him that since he has his continence recovered, that he has an extremely low likelihood that the salvage radiation will cause his continence to deteriorate. We published a small study when I was at Walter Reed looking at the impact of continence and potency on post-op radiation. And what we found is that in guys who had their continence, the post-op radiation, whether it was adjuvant or salvage, really only caused about 5% of patients to have a decrement in their continence. On the other hand, about 50% of the patients who reported potency prior to the salvage or adjuvant radiation, about 50% of them, their potency got worse. So it's not universal even that their potency will go away, but we do have to counsel them that there's a, at least on this small study, there's about a 50-50 chance whether their potency will decline substantially. And, but again, there may be newer studies since then in the radiotherapeutic literature that would support or refute that. I don't know.
I think those are reasonable estimates, both on the rate of incontinence and the rate of worsening of sexual function when radiation is used in the salvage setting. But I always remind these gentlemen that they underwent a radical prostatectomy and were willing to undergo a procedure that had a substantial risk of causing impotence. And now that there's some evidence that the cancer has come back, I think the risk-benefit ratio also would favor additional local therapy.
So one of the questions that we get or think about in that setting is the hormonal therapy. Do you add hormonal therapy or not? I mean, in terms of his management, I agree. It was unfortunately lost to follow-up, but I agree. I tend to be very aggressive on the salvage radiation therapy. I mean, there's data from Hopkins, Bruce Trock, that in, especially with the men with the bad disease, doubling time less than 6 months, you actually see a survival advantage in a retrospective study with its limitations that the data has. So I tend to be aggressive. But the question is, do you add hormones? Do you do a whole pelvis radiation? Because we did not do an extended lymph node dissection. If you do hormones combined, for how long? I've kind of developed my practice patterns, but I'm not sure I'm doing the right thing. I just don't know.
So what happened with this man?
So he's lost to follow-up, ended up coming back about a year and a half later. And, you know, his PSA before that had doubled in 3 months. It kind of kept doing that and ended up about a year and a half later at a PSA of 7.5.
So just to backtrack on that, so he lost the follow-up, he didn't get other medical care?
No.
What do you think was going on?
I don't know. I mean, we see this, you know, patient at the VA, and we see this happening that, you know, you're going along, you're getting PSAs every 3 months, every 6 months, and there's a gap for a year, year and a half.
So then he comes back to you
about 2.5 years after surgery.
2.5 years later, now his PSA is 7.5.
Right. So we did a metastatic workup at that point based upon kind of an estimated doubling time. That was negative. Kind of thought at that point the benefits of salvage radiation, that we've probably lost that window when we're really going to have a significant benefit.
Howard, what about radiation at this point?
Well, it's in my experience in seeing patients in the salvage setting, this would be highly unusual. Most patients are clued in enough to their PSA level that they won't show up with a PSA of 7.5. But let's say I did see a patient like this and there was no evidence for metastatic disease. I might even do a pelvic MRI to see if I could find some disease in the prostate bed. But even if his chance of cure with radiation was only 10%, I might consider it worth doing salvage radiation and hormone therapy. And I'm not saying that in the sense that I recommend radiation for everybody all the time. But I think that this guy, what does he have to lose for going ahead with radiation therapy? He's a poor prognostic patient, granted. His chance for a cure is extremely low. And I really do think that the morbidity is acceptable. Again, this is a patient who is willing to accept the risks of radical prostatectomy. I think the risks of salvage radiation are much less by comparison. And so I think he doesn't have too much to lose.
Anything,
and a lot to gain.
Oliver?
One thing that I really like to make clear, there are only two ways to cure prostate cancer. You either operate on it or you radiate it. And once you pass those two opportunities, you're never going to be cured again because hormonal therapy in the recurrent setting simply is not curative. So as Howard was saying, even if you came in with relatively high PSA and we don't have great database support, we don't have the prospective trials, if you don't give the radiation, you're in essence telling that patient he's never going to be cured. And I'm reluctant to pass up an opportunity for cure. So I'm very aggressive in this salvage radiation setting to ensure that patients are, first of all, followed up appropriately. I mean, this guy slipped through the cracks. When I see these patients, I counsel them. I said, look, we need to follow this PSA postoperatively because if you do have a recurrence, we have a second chance at cure. And I drill that into patients trying to diminish the risk of the inappropriate follow-up that happened here.
John?
You know, I would just, again, I'm all for a multimodality approach and giving post-op radiation therapy when it's indicated, when we clearly have a chance for benefit. And I agree with Oliver that you certainly don't want to lose the opportunity for cure when you can. But this man with a PSA of 7, realistically, his chances of cure is really, less than 5%, maybe less than 1%. If you look back at the original paper from Hopkins on combined salvage and adjuvant radiation, now granted, it's been criticized because it was relatively small, but it did have good follow-up. That I think Walsh et al. Reported about a 2% durable response to salvage radiation when you had, you know, very adverse features like that. And so I think one of the reasons that we as urologists and also as radiation oncologists, sometimes we lose credibility, both of our specialties, because we try to maybe oversell our treatments. And I think we gain more credibility if we basically back off and say, this is where we know it works, but yet we don't, you know, maybe back off on some of the futile things.
If you look at the Stevenson JCO kind of follow-up to his JAMA paper in terms of the salvage radiation, if your PSA was above 1.5, was their highest category, there was about a 10% among all comers. So this is not a 1.6, this was a 7. So I would agree. I mean, I'm not sure you could ever say a 0, but I would peg it in the 1, 2%.
Steve, could you just bring us up to date on this man?
Yeah, so he went on combined androgen blockade with the PSA of 7. PSA nadir on combined androgen blockade was 0.3, which is a poor prognostic sign. And within a couple of years, his PSA started to rise. We're stopping the anti-androgen now and waiting to see what happens.
So, Matt, what would you be thinking about in terms of your next most likely option on this man as his PSA starts to come up, or if it starts to come up?
These are patients who I would restage because I think it does alter management quite a bit. If you look hard enough, you will find metastatic disease, even patients with a low PSA that's rising in the castrate setting, and it does make a difference about management. If he has no detectable metastatic disease, I'd be inclined to observe him for a while following discontinuation of bicalutamide.
We had looked at that in our VA series with CRPC, castrate-resistant M0, with a PSA below 5. Of the patients just retrospectively who did get bone scans, almost all were negative. Once the PSA hit 5, we started to see bone scan positives. So that's kind of what I'm incorporating as my algorithm to start the scan based upon our VA data.
So Steve, can you kind of pick out a few key points, particularly in terms of recent new data sets in PSA-only disease that you think docs in practice should know about?
In the PSA recurrent setting, certainly doubling time is the number one factor. Obviously, your absolute PSA tells you, I mean, doubling time tells you how fast your tumor is growing, and the PSA will tell you how big it is. If you know how big it is and how fast it's growing, you can probably predict where it's going to be tomorrow and where it's going to ultimately get to mets and death. So those would be the two key things. In multivariate analysis, some of the things that have also panned out in some studies, not others, the Hopkins data in particular, have been the Gleason score post-surgery, the primary Gleason score, and then the time to recurrence in a multivariate model did add significantly to prognostication, again, in the Hopkins series. Has not always panned out in all series, though.
What are some of the ongoing trials? I'll start with Oliver, looking in the PSA-only space that are either out there and have been accrued and we're waiting for results or ongoing right now.
Well, there's a docetaxel trial, and that trial is looking at whether or not early chemotherapy can actually alter the natural history of the disease in a significant way. It's been accruing pretty slowly, actually. Other trials in that space, one of which recently reported was the intermittent versus continuous hormone, and this showed absolutely no differences in overall survival, potentially some quality of life issues that might be a little better in the intermittent. Certainly when I'm using hormonal therapy in this setting, I'm now going to the intermittent type approach.
Did you use intermittent with him?
No, we didn't. I'm not a huge fan. I mean, if you look at the studies that have been published or presented on intermittent, you see a slight worsening of cancer control in the intermittent, but a slight benefit towards overall non-prostate cancer. You know, in terms of the quality of life, it's actually not been nearly as beneficial as you would think. Because in theory, you're on hormones for a year, you're off it for a year, you should only have the decrement half the time. But I think the problem is when you're on hormones, quote unquote, for a year, it takes you 6-8 months for your testosterone to recover. And so of the 2 years, you only get a few months where actually off hormones.
So let's move on to our next topic, which I'm really looking forward to hear about because it's new, namely Cipulucyl T. Phil, your PowerPoint talk, which is now on our website, has some great graphics explaining some of the presumed mechanisms of action of this agent. Can you summarize how you conceptualize this?
This is a concept that was originated probably in the 1990s, and that is to try to introduce a prostate antigen, specifically prostatic acid phosphatase, coupled to an immunostimulatory molecule, GM-CSF, expose white blood cells, specifically in this case, antigen-presenting cells, to that antigen, stimulating the antigen-presenting cells and incubating them for a period of time, 2 to 3 days, and then infusing those cells back into the patient. And those stimulated antigen-presenting cells presumably activate T cells, which are the effector cells for the immune system against the tumor. So that's the concept behind dendritic cell approaches in general, and that's the presumed mechanism by which cipolucel T works. Although, in honesty, we really don't know what the actual mechanism of action of cipolucel T is.
What about side effects and toxicity with this agent? Any autoimmune problems, as was reported with the cell-based immunotherapy ipilimumab reported at ASCO in melanoma?
There are sort of acute phase reactions, headache, fever, flu-like symptoms that are associated with it. But as best could be seen, there are not specifically immunological side effects that are seen with cipolucel T.
So I want to get into exactly what happens to the patient and the time course of how it happens, and particularly the clinical data. But before we do, just go to Oliver and say, how do you like the science here? Does it make sense? Or like, maybe not.
But, you know, I was skeptical of the science, but what swayed me was the consistency in the overall survival benefit. You know, I actually don't have to understand the science. I have to understand how long people are living and their quality of life. And in this case, in the initial trials, which were, in my mind, quite small and not necessarily reproducible because I didn't have the data at that time, I was a skeptic. And now that we have larger trials showing really quite consistent results with a control arm that lived the right amount of time. You know, I was a little bit concerned that, you know, maybe the control arm would be worse than expected or something. It turned out the control was right on target, and there was a survival benefit. So I'm convinced.
I agree with you, Oliver. I think, you know, I entered this whole thing with a great deal of skepticism about immunotherapy in general. And it's really been the clinical data that's driven this whole thing forward. The mechanistic data is not fully understood. There isn't much of it. And that's what we have to do over the next few years, is to try to figure out how it worked.
What actually happens if a physician decides they want to use this therapy? What do they do, and what's the time course of how it evolves?
If it's appropriate for a patient, and that's guided by the label, which is asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic patients with castration-resistant prostate cancer. And I think an appropriate patient at this point is somebody with fairly, as we've said before, indolent disease, where the disease is not progressing so rapidly that the patient really requires moving on to some other therapy rapidly, because presumably you want the immune therapy and the immunological response, which probably takes weeks, if not months, to take place to allow it to work. So if that decision is made for the appropriate patient, they undergo a leukapheresis.
Where do they go to do that?
It depends upon the center. At this point, there's somewhere between 50 and 100 centers in the country that are doing it. In some centers, like ours, we actually do the leukapheresis ourselves. In some centers, there's a centralized facility where the leukapheresis takes place.
So blood bank?
Typically Red Cross.
A Red Cross locally, regionally. So the patient gets a leukapheresis over a few-hour period of time, which is a well-tolerated procedure. The patient then goes home, and the cells are then shipped to a central facility. And the number of these facilities is expanding right now. And over the course of a 2 to 3 day period of time, what I described before, which is exposure of those cells after capturing the white cell fraction from the blood, are exposed to this fusion antigen of prostatic acid phosphatase and GM-CSF for a period of several days, presumably stimulating the antigen-presenting cells. After that period of time, the cells are then shipped back to the center, and they're infused in the infusion room over a short period of time.
So how long does it take to get back to the patient?
Well, it's a 2 to 3 day period of time for processing, and then after it's processed, it's 1 day for shipping.
But what I mean is, from the time you send it to the time the patient can be treated, how long is it usually?
It's about a 4 day process.
That's pretty quick. Anyone have any experience practically with using this, Bob?
Yeah, as Phil has described, it's a 3-pheresis, 3-infusion process over the course of 4 weeks. and patients tolerate it well in terms of the infusion.
How many patients have you treated and over what period of time?
Well, we've now enrolled our sixth patient since we became active about 6 weeks ago.
Any side effects and toxicity observations?
No, I mean, similar to the trial. I mean, it's a well-tolerated process.
Anything while we're talking about, of course, we want to get into the efficacy, but just want to comment overall on what's been seen in the studies in terms of side effects, toxicity?
You know, as I said before, the main side effects are fever, headaches, acute phase reactions, but very little else.
Judd, what about urologists utilizing this treatment? Do you think it's going to happen? Is it happening?
It is. Some of the sites are primarily driven by urologists. And since this is not a systemic chemotherapy per se, urologists would be, at many institutions, including ours, would be credentialed to administer this therapy. We're generally not credentialed at our institution to administer systemic chemotherapy, but we would be credentialed to do this. So a urologist could do this. Again, I think that this is a treatment that should be in the context of a multidisciplinary approach. I think it's going to be best served in centers that embrace a multidisciplinary approach where urologists are working together with medical oncologists and radiation oncologists. What I find ironic is that, you know, ever since I've been in the field, they've said, oh, you know, prostate cancer is 20 years behind breast cancer, and we've been hearing that for the last 20 years. It's funny that here we have this really novel therapy. It's the first FDA-approved cell-based immunotherapy, and it's in prostate cancer.
So, Matt, do you agree or disagree? Generally speaking, any patient with metastatic prostate cancer should at least see a medical oncologist before implementing this kind of therapy, as opposed to having a urologist go ahead and start it.
Well, there's a spectrum of care. So there is an overall survival benefit. We'll be doing it at our center. I support its use in the patients who are appropriate according to the package insert. I don't think urologists should be the lead in doing this. And the reason is because the patients who are in this disease state are going to require other therapies. They're typically in the last few years of their life. And if the person administering Sipuleucel-T is not going to be then doing their subsequent salvage therapy with chemotherapy and other drugs, I think it would be preferable that they're either in the care of a medical oncologist or, as Judd suggested, at least in a multidisciplinary clinic where that expertise is available.
What about, let's get into the real, I think, controversial, interesting thing about the data. Can you go through the actual trials that were done and in particular the efficacy data?
Mm-hmm. So the first trial that was done was a trial known as 9901, and I guess the 99 signifies that it started in 1999, and Eric Small led the study. And it was technically a randomized phase 3 study, but relatively small, 127 patients. And the study included patients with metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer who were asymptomatic. Initially, only patients with non-high-grade cancer were included, and ultimately patients with high-grade cancer were included later on. The primary endpoint in the study was progression-free survival, and the secondary endpoint was overall survival. And Eric Small presented this data several years ago at, I believe, GU ASCO, and we were all quite curious about the findings in that there was a separation in the progression-free survival with a hazard ratio of about 1.4, but it did not reach statistical significance. So that was the primary endpoint. Yet survival with further follow-up was positive, with a median survival difference of somewhere between 4 and 5 months, and that was statistically significant. And as you know, that study was brought to the FDA and contemplated whether it should be approved, and it was ultimately denied. There was a parallel study that included fewer patients, similar population of patients, that failed to meet statistical significance in the primary or secondary endpoint of progression-free or overall survival, although the hazard ratio for survival similarly was diminished about 0.78 in that study. But those two studies together indicated that there might be a survival signal, two small studies, and that prompted the large impact study, which included 512 patients. But at this time, survival was the primary endpoint rather than progression-free survival. So 512 patients were randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion. These patients were either asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion to receive either the cell-based immunotherapy, Sipuleucel-T, or placebo.
Again, this is metastatic disease.
This is metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, followed for progression and ultimately followed for survival. And in that study, about 50% of patients were crossed over from the placebo arm to the cell-based immunotherapy, cipolucel T arm. And patients were subsequently treated after progression with a variety of different treatments, including crossover as well as chemotherapy about 50% of the time. But ultimately, despite all this, the difference in survival was significant, about 4.1 months between the two arms. Progression-free survival was pretty much the same. There was no difference in the two arms.
And how was that defined, progression-free survival?
Radiographically.
Not PSA?
Not PSA.
And not necessarily changing of treatment? Or did they all have... So it was radiographic progression.
Radiographic progression, which, as we all know around the table, occurs very, very quickly. So the median time to progression in the study is several months, presumably quicker than the immunotherapy could actually work.
So this happens in many trials in medical oncology that the oncologists have to scratch their head about, and then they turn around and go, okay, well, why? How could you extend survival without extending progression-free survival? Theoretically, thinking about what you just said about how it works, what's going on?
Right. Well, I don't know the answer to that question, but I can bring forward a few possibilities. First of all, it's not something that we haven't seen in other trials. There has been, in a variety of trials, disconnects between progression-free survival and overall survival, going both ways, where you see improvements in progression-free survival, yet no benefits with regard to overall survival. And we've actually seen trials similar to this where you do see a benefit in survival and no benefit in terms of progression-free survival. And one of the hypotheses in all these trials is that progression is poorly defined. We don't have very good parameters to measure progression accurately. We rely very heavily on the bone scan since it's a bone-predominant disease, and bone scans are notoriously unreliable in this disease. So one possibility is this disconnect and our failure to accurately measure progression.
So actually the tumor is being slowed down, it's just we can't pick it up in the trial.
One possibility is that the progression endpoint is a poor endpoint and doesn't correlate well with overall survival. The second possibility, which to me is a little more pleasing but certainly untested, is that the effects of the vaccine or cell-based immunotherapy occur after progression slowly. And after that initial progression where a person is defined as having progression is that time when the, as you would say, the cancer slows down and you haven't captured any meaningful clinical difference in the two arms during that short period of time and it can only be measured afterwards where the scrutiny of following patients with serial bone scans and CAT scans has diminished and that you're only looking at the endpoint of survival. And I think that's certainly a possibility as well. But at this point in time, I'd have to say that we don't really have a good explanation. I think it's going to take more research to fully understand what's going on with regard to that disconnect.
I want to get Matt's take on this, but just one more related question. Theoretically, trying to understand, you know, what immune function is and what this thing's trying to do, why would you only want to give it three times? I mean, it almost sounds like a vaccination as opposed to immune therapy.
Yeah, I think the reason it's given three times is historical and perhaps convenience is that that's the way this was given when originally developed. But it is entirely conceivable that giving more of the immunotherapy might be better. We don't have an answer to that. But you're right. You know, theoretically, it is like a vaccination rather than a continuous immunotherapy, and we haven't tested that hypothesis yet.
Okay, I've been looking forward to this for weeks. Please help me understand this. Let's start with Matt.
This is a really remarkable product profile, right? You have a meaningful, substantial improvement in overall survival with no discernible impact on time to progression. I like your second explanation quite a bit, but the first one I have a harder time supporting because while time to progression is challenging to ascertain, it's been very clearly ascertained in a variety of studies of other drugs that improve survival. And in fact, for chemotherapy, docetaxel, cabazitaxel, the improvement in time to progression is highly statistically significant and about twice that of the observed overall survival benefit. And by the way, even despite what Kevin Kelly said about docetaxel Avastin, that there was a disconnection, there's absolutely no disconnection. There's a perfect connection. Avastin improved time to progression by 2 months, and in a non-significant way, extended survival by 1 month. So the exact same 2-to-1 ratio that's been seen with docetaxel, with cabazitaxel. So I accept that it's imperfect, but a variety of well-done prospective clinical trials have shown a clear improvement on time to progression. So I think we come back to this remarkable product profile. It doesn't diminish the value of Sipuleucel-T. I just think we have a lot to learn about how it's really acting. Because
the only thing I would say, I think Matthew is absolutely right, that other categories of drugs have shown perhaps a clearer connection between progression and overall survival, particularly cytotoxic agents and perhaps hormonal therapies, which cause an immediate decline in cell number. But that's not the presumed mechanism of action of a vaccine, where it might take a longer period of time to actually see that difference in progression.
Are there markers in terms of response, immunologic response, that can be looked at?
That's a great question. You know, that's what we need so badly. This is one of the problems in the field of immunotherapy and immunology in general, is that there are no good predictors of those people who might respond to an immunotherapy and no good indicators of those people who are responding to the treatment.
I mean, when people kind of plan the study, of course, it's always easier in hindsight. You know, what was the thinking in terms of, was the thought out there maybe, listen, this takes about 6 months to really work, or 4 months, and the people are going to progress, but then, you know, they're going to kind of catch up or slow down?
I think the reality is, I mean, and let's be honest about this, this particular therapy has been tortured over the decade. This controversy about mechanism, lack of understanding of mechanism, has impacted on how the trial was conducted in terms of resources to support the trial, the ability to do correlates. I think in a perfect world, there would have been a lot of things done differently that were not done because, frankly, economically, in the absence of evidence that any of these studies were useful in the human setting to be able to justify it. Let me throw out another mechanism for you, which has been talked about, and again, it's ethereal. But the reality is that if you look across the last 3 decades of immunomodulatory therapies, there have been mostly anecdotal experiences where a variety of immune-based modulatory therapies in epithelial cancers have been followed in patients getting systemic chemotherapy. And there are reports across the literature of unexpected levels of response to subsequent cytotoxic therapy. So in this particular entity, where the majority of patients ultimately got cytotoxic therapy, some immune modulatory impact on subsequent therapy is also one of the sort of, again, very ethereal hypothetical mechanisms in terms of how this kind of non-objective response therapy can then subsequently lead to a survival benefit.
So let me clarify that in saying that one of the issues is, could the differences between the two arms be accounted for
because they got chemo.
The differential use in some way of docetaxel? Because in fact, the people who got the cellular immunotherapy, Sipuleucel-T, actually received slightly more docetaxel. And when you do a multivariate analysis and all the analyses that are attempts at trying to prove that docetaxel differences between the two arms might account for it, there is no sign that the differential use of docetaxel had anything to do with the differential impact. What Rob is talking about is something that's been tossed around in the immunotherapy world for a while, and it is really anecdotal at this point, and that is that immunotherapy might sensitize an individual to subsequent therapies. And that's entirely true, but it was not the question that was asked in this trial, certainly. I think it's an interesting question, but it's at this point no more than a presumed mechanism.
So I want to get back to the sort of nitty-gritty of decision-making today. You know, and kind of fresh off this data becoming available or becoming approved. Why don't we go to your first case as an example and find out what you all are actually doing in your practices today?
Okay. So this is a 55-year-old man with a PSA of 12 and a Gleason score of 8 with no evidence of metastases. He undergoes a radical prostatectomy in 2004. His pathology reveals extensive Gleason 4+4 with extracapsular extension, but no seminal vesicle involvement, invasion, or lymph node involvement. His PSA initially is undetectable, but it begins to increase from 0.01 to 0.04 to 0.11. He undergoes radiation with a decrease in his PSA to 0.04. In 2006, his PSA starts to climb again, and when his PSA reaches 2, he started on hormonal therapy in the form of leuprolide and bicalutamide. At that point in time, no metastases are found. His PSA then becomes undetectable again. In 2008, his PSA starts to increase again while on androgen deprivation therapy. His testosterone at that time is castrate at 16. His bicalutamide is discontinued to try to elicit a anti-androgen withdrawal response. He started on nilutamide, but his PSA continues to climb. He's then treated with a combination therapy, which includes ketoconazole and dutasteride hydrocortisone, and that causes an initial drop in his PSA, but then it begins to rise again up to 5. That ketoconazole combination is discontinued. At that point in time, his bone scan reveals a new L2 lesion, and he's asymptomatic.
So, Bob, how would you be thinking about management of the patient at this point, usually, let's say 6 months ago, just as a baseline?
So typically, I wouldn't treat this patient, obviously, with chemotherapy, given the lack of symptoms. And I think that he's been heavily manipulated with regards to second-line intervention. So in the current treatment paradigm, in the absence of other therapies, I probably would observe this patient expectantly. Now, in today's world, this is a patient who meets the sort of definition of a candidate for Cipuleucel T. So that would certainly be something we would discuss with the patient because he's the sort of prototypical candidate.
So, Steve, what about Cipuleucel T at this point right now in your own practice? And what about a couple months ago when he didn't have the positive bone scan but his PSA was progressing?
Well, I agree with Robert. At this point, I think he's a great candidate for Cipuleucel T. He meets the criteria from the FDA for on-label use. It's been shown to have survival benefits, so I think it's a good option for him. We don't have many other options. I think the comment that Robert made, very interesting, that he wouldn't give chemo because the patient's asymptomatic. I think that's preference, and you know, different people have different practice patterns, and I think that's one of the things that I've seen from a urology point of view, I think that leads to a little bit of frustration is, you know, we operate on patients, put them at risk for a lot of side effects when they're asymptomatic. We use hormonal therapy for PSA recurrence, admittedly too much, too early. We're going to discuss that. I don't disagree, but we do that when they're asymptomatic. So now all of a sudden you have a patient with metastatic disease, a couple of years to live, and to say, well, I'm not going to do the next therapy until he's symptomatic has led, I think, on some urologist part to frustration. I think some urologists are starting to do chemotherapy because they want to be more aggressive than some of our partners.
How about your urologists at Duke? What do they generally do? Do they do what Bob does?
They tend to be a little bit more aggressive. I don't think super aggressive. We are giving Cipuleucel T, and I think for me, one of the nice things about being in academics is we have phenomenal medical oncology colleagues that I can refer to, and we kind of unofficially have a line that once they do become metastatic, that really is where medical oncology, at least at our institution, takes over. So I'd refer them to Dan George or one of my partners there, and they would do the Cipuleucel T, see how it goes, and then transition to chemo.
So that's good, Judd. I'm hearing oncologists aren't being aggressive enough about giving chemo. I don't hear that too much.
Well, you know, this man, obviously, he does have a positive bone scan. He would meet on-label criteria for Cipuleucel T or docetaxel. Although, if I hear Dr. Kanoff saying, and what I've heard is if you start Cipuleucel T, you would like to have a fairly significant period of time after Cipuleucel T before you initiate chemotherapy. And that's one of the clinical questions is, if you do the Cipuleucel T, how long do you have to wait then before you would administer docetaxel?
Yeah, I did say that, but I said that not fully knowing that for sure. In my own mind, I've sort of come to the conclusion that you need time for the immunotherapy to work before you go to the next treatment. But in fact, on the study, there were patients who were treated fairly quickly, and it did not seem to matter in the study when patients receive subsequent chemotherapy. So I think it's a theoretical paradigm at this point that remains unanswered.
Actually, let me just throw one point out that maybe Phil would want to comment on. One of the evolving discussions about the use of Cipuleucel T in this context is the use of other immune modulatory therapy along with it. So docetaxel and prednisone.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of issues about how we're going to be able to figure that out without any data.
Yeah, the other part is part of his last regimen was hydrocortisone. And so I don't believe anyone knows how long a period they should be off prior to glucocorticoids, but you do like some window of time for them to be off.
That's a really great point. What is your recommendation or thoughts in terms of steroids at the same time or soon thereafter? Or can, actually, in the think tank, Tom Lynch was here who had looked at ipilimumab, and they realized they were giving it with paclitaxel where they were giving the steroids. They didn't see the autoimmune effects, but they also didn't see that much benefit. Is there any reason to think that by giving steroids, even 2 months later or 3 months later when you're getting chemo, it in some way would inhibit the cipulucel effect?
Yeah, I think it's a theoretical concern at this point, and enough for me to get back to my original point, and that is you'd like to select patients with more indolent disease so you have a longer period of time to get patients off of steroids before you start people on docetaxel plus, if you use it, a steroid along with it. So it gets back to selection of patients having more indolent disease, because I think theoretically you'd like to give some time between the steroid and the use of a cell-based immunotherapy, although frankly we just don't know.
Final comment from Steve.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very exciting. We've kind of entered the age of immunotherapy. I think the challenge is going to be how we move forward. Given what we've heard, it sounds like cipolizumab T, I mean, you give it, but it may be working slowly over the next 2 years. So I'd worry about how you define failure to go on to the next immunotherapy trial, and are you going to do something in that trial that actually negates the effects of cipolizumab T that's still working? I think it's much easier in a docetaxel. I'm not 100% convinced we know how that works. There's still some controversy with that. But, I mean, you see the PSA goes down, tumor progresses, they've kind of failed. You can go on to the next one. It's clear. I think there's a lot of challenges in this, but it's exciting.
So let's get on to our next topic, sort of moving through the natural history of the disease and talk about chemotherapy for metastatic disease. Oliver, can you sort of backtrack a little bit and summarize what we know about docetaxel and then talk about the newly approved taxane, cabazitaxel?
Sure. Docetaxel has been FDA approved since 2004, and I've kind of been calling it the pivot point. The way the trials have developed, either we're going to come before docetaxel, we're going to come with docetaxel, or we're going to come after docetaxel. So the cibazitaxel-T is sort of logically fitting in the pre-docetaxel space, although it doesn't necessarily have to be there. And the trials with docetaxel have yet to have a survival advantage. There have been several trials that have attempted to be superior to docetaxel in combination with, but as of yet, nothing has really been shown to be effective. The post-docetaxel space, and we started off with the SPARC trial, that was cisplatin-prednisone, and even though there was a little progression-free survival advantage, the overall survival was not apparent. And then the cabazitaxel study came along, and there was not a lot of preclinical data. There was a phase one, and then it went straight into phase three. And that raised a few eyebrows because people were saying, you know, well, why are you doing a phase three? You don't have good phase two data. But in the preclinical models, there was some very provocative findings. In the phase one, there was some interesting results. And the decision was made to launch straight into a phase three. And that trial was positive. And rather remarkably, after the trial results were publicly announced and then the NDA filed, it took only about 80 days, third fastest FDA approval ever, between the submission of the NDA and the approval. So it's FDA approved in June.
Can you give us a little more of a flavor? What type of agent cabazitaxel is? Is it more like docetaxel or paclitaxel?
It's a chemically modified taxane. And I mean, chemically speaking, it has a couple of methoxy groups sort of hanging around in different spots. But, you know, I think the important thing was this grew out of the old Rompoint Rohrer chemistry. And they had developed taxanes and were very interested in trying to find novel taxanes that would operate and be effective in cells and models that were docetaxel resistant. So the development strategy going way back to the chemistry was to design new taxanes that would work when docetaxel would not. And that pipeline yielded cabazitaxel. And of course, then it got into the patients, had clinical activity in patients in the phase one, then the phase three, and of course, now the survival results are positive.
I'm going to talk about the studies and the results, but just first, what about the side effects toxicity profile of this agent compared to docetaxel, compared to other taxanes such as paclitaxel?
It's very docetaxel-like. Neutropenia, diarrhea, sort of predominant. And the thing I think that may be a little bit deceptive, and interestingly, Steve and I were talking about this right beforehand, and when you look at the toxicity profile, you might think it's a more toxic agent. But importantly, the second-line chemotherapy setting is an opportunity for patients to, of course, have much more pretreatment, so the patients are more beat up. Interestingly, mitoxantrone was given in the control arm in both the docetaxel as well as cabazitaxel phase 3 trials. And when we look at the mitoxantrone, like grade 3-4 neutropenia, in the second line setting, 58% of the patients had grade 3-4 neutropenia. Same drug, mitoxantrone, same dose, same schedule, in frontline was only 22%. So when you shift the setting in which the drug is administered, the toxicities can appear to vary, but actually I think it's pretty docetaxel-like. Probably a little more neutropenia, but very docetaxel-like, I think, in the side effects.
So can you go through the clinical data that we have on this agent, and particularly the TROPiC study?
Sure. So TROPiC is a large international trial, run 755 patients. The treatment was cabazitaxel, 25 milligrams per meter squared, plus prednisone, 10 milligrams a day versus mitoxantrone, and also giving prednisone. We'll talk briefly about the control arm. I think it's important. So in this setting, in this post-docetaxel progression setting, there's not been any standard of care. It's clearly an unmet need. If we look at other trials in the space, for instance, we look at Medivation trial, the NDV-3100, they're using placebo as the control. If we look at the abiraterone trial, they were using prednisone only as control. Look at satraplatin, it was prednisone only in the control group. So the TROPiC trial used mitoxantrone prednisone, which I think is a reasonable comparator arm. And mitoxantrone had been used and had a little bit of clinical trial data. So mitoxantrone being the control arm, I think, is a very legitimate control here. The cabazitaxel, administered every 3 weeks, and 25 milligrams per meter squared. Interesting, a little corollary there that may be worth mentioning. The amount of the polysorbate 80, which is the carrier compound used for docetaxel and cabazitaxel, because the dose of the cabazitaxel is only one-third, you end up with less polysorbate 80 as well. And that's been responsible for some of these kind of acute reactions associated with docetaxel. You do not have to give oral dexamethasone pretreatment with cabazitaxel.
So what actually is the steroid use when you give cabazitaxel?
Using intravenous dexamethasone immediately before the treatment, and that is all that you give in terms of prophylaxis. Now, you are given the prednisone 10 milligrams a day along with it. Anyway, bottom line, in this prospective randomized trial, the primary endpoint being overall survival, it was an excellent hazard ratio, 0.7. Median survival, and of course, we talked about medians a little bit earlier and how they can be both accurate and deceptive. Median survival, 12.7 months for mitoxantrone, 15.1 months for the cabazitaxel. When the curves split, it was a nice split. I mean, even beyond the median, the curves were still splitting pretty widely apart. Survival for those who were out at 2 years was substantially higher than the cabazitaxel arm. And anyway, we have an effective new therapy for the metastatic castrate-resistant patient who progresses despite prior docetaxel. First trial, and going back to the theme earlier, which I liked, you know, how the breast guys are always ahead of us. This time, cabazitaxel was tested first in prostate, and this is the FDA approval, leading in prostate. It's not like with a lot of the other taxanes where the other disease were leading.
So is this being tested in other tumors and which ones?
Well, absolutely. It'll go forward in lung, it'll go forward in some breast, probably go forward in some head and neck. So those are strategy discussions at the company level, but it'll go forth in a wide variety of tumors.
Any sort of overall clinical impression in terms of quality of life of these patients? Let's say if you could project in the same line of therapy, more in terms of how they feel, cabazitaxel versus docetaxel.
Very similar, not formally assessed. I think cabazitaxel probably has a little more neutropenia. Could be a dose effect. You know, moving into this was some controversy of where the dose was going to be selected. 25 milligrams per meter squared was an outcome from one of the phase ones. Some discussion about 20 milligrams per meter squared. Is it dose? Is it setting? Is it drug? You know, some things that are going to require sort of the upfront trial in order to really decipher.
What about recommendations or, you know, sort of the algorithm in terms of growth factors with cabazitaxel?
Yeah. Very good point. So within the package insert, the FDA took upon themselves to make some specific growth factor recommendations, which is a little bit unusual. In the TROPiC trial, first cycle growth factors were not recommended and actually discouraged. They were trying to get a little handle on what might be present. And what they found and what the FDA has recommended is that for men greater than age 65 with an R, a performance status that's a little down, R prior febrile neutropenia, R prior extensive radiation, R other comorbidities, rather undefined, that first cycle prophylaxis would be considered with G-CSF. And when you start looking at that category of greater than age 65, that's actually going to be a lot of these men. So I think this is an agent in which growth factor use should be encouraged. I hope that people will look at the package insert carefully and follow the guidelines. I think that's a good guideline and one that I'm going to be using.
John? Now, I've heard in our multidisciplinary group, there's some challenge with Medicare patients on prophylactic growth factor support and Medicare reimbursement that makes it a challenge for certain patients.
This is a really good point, Judd. Right now, we have an FDA-approved agent with a package insert recommendation, and I'm going to fight to try to make sure that the appropriate patients receive the appropriate growth factors. And I don't think that in my practice we've yet encountered a huge amount of resistance, but what I'll say is when you have a package insert, that's pretty powerful rationale for using those particular drugs.
What are the numbers without growth factors that you see with cabazitaxel?
7.5% febrile neutropenia, and actually breaking it down by subset was not done, but the FDA made their recommendations based on some subset analyses that they did not actually show the data for.
So let's start to tease out the algorithm of initial and subsequent management of metastatic disease. Matt, right now, outside of a protocol setting, how are you thinking through sequencing Cipulucil-T, docetaxel, and cabazitaxel? And maybe we'll just put secondary hormonal therapy and other chemo aside for a second and focus on those three.
I think one of the important points to make about cabazitaxel is we welcome this agent. It's good to have another tool to treat the disease. But early on in our practices, we have lots of patients who have had no other therapeutic options. And so the issues about safety are going to be particularly important in them. Some of the early patients I've treated are patients who have had 2, 3, 4 lines of other therapy or have been off therapy for quite a while because they've had no therapeutic options and have decreased performance status. So we're being very cautious about those patients.
How have they done, incidentally?
Okay. The toxicities are, like Oliver described, the first patient I treated required a scheduled delay because of persistent thrombocytopenia. Early on seemed to be more GI toxicity than with first-line docetaxel, with all the caveats that Oliver described about the fact that the subjects, patients being treated, are further advanced, poor performance status than, say, the typical first-line docetaxel patient. So I think it's an important tool. And I think one of the really interesting questions becomes how this will play out in the community. Will physicians treat patients with first-line docetaxel and reserve cabazitaxel to docetaxel failures, or will they just roll it all up and say, well, just start with cabazitaxel? From an evidence-based perspective, of course, the right response to that will require further head-to-head trials of the two agents.
What about you in your own non-protocol practice? What's your sequence?
I will treat patients with first-line docetaxel and reserve cabazitaxel for patients who progress despite docetaxel.
And where are you going to bring in cipuleucel T before that, if they're asymptomatic?
Oh, absolutely. So the preference would be for the patients, like we've discussed earlier, asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic, who don't have a pressing need for other therapies. The idea would be to get cipuleucel T treatment administered and sort of out of the way, and then monitor the patient as we would otherwise and go on to other treatments as is appropriate based on their progression.
Bob, what's your experience with cabazitaxel?
Again, similar to what Oliver has described, it is clearly, remember, we're now in a sort of a mid-portion where drug approval occurred. Many of the patients that are being treated have had, in those patients who get multiple therapies, have had 2 and 3 lines of therapy. So it's not necessarily what it's going to look like a year from now. I think the issues that we as clinicians need to work through is the issue of retreatment with docetaxel versus using cabazitaxel as salvage. And that's going to be somewhat addressed in future randomized trials in terms of upfront therapy. So for my paradigm, currently in a non-protocol setting, for patients who've had good responses to docetaxel, I'm inclined to retreat with docetaxel because, again, although in that setting it's palliative intent, I have no prospective data a la the survival data from the cabazitaxel trial, I still think that's a reasonable management paradigm. But I certainly would bring cabazitaxel in lieu of using other agents, mitoxantrone, carboplatin, things like that.
It was always interesting to try to tease out what people's clinical experiences are compared to what they might read in a paper that's constrained.
I think there's no question, for example, in our group, there's 6 geometric oncs, and the first 3 patients, none of them which were mine, were treated. All were prophylaxed, all wound up in the hospital with febrile neutropenia. My tendency in these heavily treated patients, and I think it's a bias of mine, is to actually dose at 20 milligrams in lieu of using growth factor up front.
Again, I ask about quality of life, and you know, it's particularly difficult for people outside of medical oncology to get a feel for this, such as your referring urologist. But if you're, you know, best way you can, going to try to compare, for example, docetaxel to cabazitaxel, overall, let's say in a, you know, fairly healthy 65, 70-year-old patient, what fraction of patients on either of those drugs would sort of cruise through without any real major problems? What fraction would really have a major quality of life or complication problem?
You know, I think it's hard for us to know that because these are clearly not the same patient populations. You really can't compare a beat-up patient to a patient who's getting frontline docetaxel. The one thing I would add, though, is I'm using second and third line therapy not as a PSA parameter, but trying to deal with symptoms. So in that context, both these agents clearly have efficacy in terms of symptom modulation. I don't think we're going to clearly know the answer that you're asking until the frontline trial is done.
Phil, what's your experience?
Yeah, I actually completely agree with Rob. You know, with regard to sequencing, your first question with cipuleucel T, docetaxel retreatment followed by cabazitaxel, I agree with what you're saying about the neutropenia. And the question is it apples and oranges? Are we comparing different patient populations or is it a different drug? We participated, as you know, in the TROPIC trial with you, Oliver, and we've treated a fair number of patients off protocol now. And I'm impressed with the amount of neutropenia in this setting, given 25 milligrams and with prophylaxis. It is quite a bit higher than seen with docetaxel. Once again, different setting. So as it rolls out into the community, I think people do need to know that that's going to be an issue. It's not as easy as treating frontline docetaxel.
Are there databases out there that tell us what fraction of people who at first diagnosis with metastatic disease have a lot of symptoms, of some symptoms, no symptoms?
So we've been looking at that a little bit. We are in the process of building that through the VA. I've worked with community urologists, you know, and that's where I'm definitely hearing a little bit of divide between, I think, the medical oncology practice patterns and urology practice patterns, and that I think urologists are screening a little bit more aggressively for metastatic disease, not waiting for symptoms, whether we're doing it too aggressively or not aggressively enough. It depends on what therapies you have or what you're going to offer. But, you know, when you talk to urologists, they are usually starting to scan once the PSA starts to rise on hormonal therapy triggered by absolute PSA values, PSA kinetics. not waiting for symptoms as the trigger. So I think in a urology practice, the majority of these mets will be picked up asymptomatic. And we have data now that's not yet published, but again, looking at large group urology practices where we are starting to see a lot of these men being picked up asymptomatic, which then creates that conundrum of what to do with that man and kind of the SIPL-SOL-T patient population, because I know there's reluctance to give chemo. Urologists generally don't give chemo, but we want to be aggressive. So there's at least something now filling that void.
That's a good point. I wonder if practice patterns will change a little bit given the emergence of SIPL-SOL-T in looking for...
Correct.
Looking for metastatic disease.
You have a hammer now. Let's go start looking for nails.
If we were going to the practice of urologists and say, tell us about every patient you've diagnosed with metastatic disease in the last 2 years, would they say most of those men were asymptomatic? And then we're going to ask them, what did you do? Are they going to say, I held on to them or I referred them?
So we've done that. And with this community-based group, we've looked at, it was about 150 patients. And a lot of them were asymptomatic. And the issues, it really came down to local dynamics with their medical oncologists, and often would get a referral to medical oncology at the time of metastatic disease. This was pre-SIPL-SOL-T days. So the idea was they have metastatic disease, I'm going to refer them for chemo. And the problem is they were often coming back from the medical oncologist not receiving chemo. These urologists were more progressive than I think a lot of urologists in terms of that they were giving bisphosphonates, which is something you could actually have a therapeutic intervention for metastatic disease. So I think it really comes down to a lot of why are you doing the bone scan? Well, you're doing it to look for mets. So what? What are you going to do differently now that you have metastatic disease? You can give a bisphosphonates. You can give SIPL-SOL-T. There's clinical trials, which urologists are more and more, especially these large group practices, involved with. So I think it is a tipping point and opens the door to more therapies. And I think we're going to be even more aggressive in our screening for mets in the future.
So Oliver, let's get into management in practice. Why don't you present your 69-year-old man?
Sure. So I won't go into all the past history, but a 69-year-old fellow, and at this point he's having some increasing back and hip pain, had numerous new bone lesions on his bone scan, progressive rise in his PSA, been previously treated with radical prostatectomy, then ended up having combined androgen blockade, then went on a clinical trial, abiraterone prednisone, and, you know, of course it's blinded, and I'm not sure exactly what he received, but I suspect he was on the abiraterone, and had a nice response, but then progressed. Put him on a little dexamethasone. Then went on another clinical trial briefly with radium-223. We haven't really talked about that. That's one of those investigational agents. And now the LDH is up, the PSA is up, and he's still got a pretty reasonable performance status. And I talked to this guy about chemotherapy, and he was just very, very reluctant. He just, you know, he had a block about chemotherapy.
What was his lifestyle like at that point?
Actually, really quite good.
Working?
Yep. He's an interesting fellow, a dog trainer, and then he runs kind of a small farm on the side, and active guy, working.
And at that particular point, what was your assessment of him in terms of symptomatology? You said he had some aches. Where were they? How bad were they?
Well, not too bad, but it was beginning to interfere with his activities of daily living. They were diffuse, I think, related to his diffuse metastatic disease. It was not like there was a focal area pain, otherwise it would have sent him to radiation and, you know, had that focal area taken care of. But he was diffuse. He's taken a lot of ibuprofen. He's not feeling as good as he used to, and he's beginning to have a little fatigue as well.
So, Matt, what would you be thinking about at this point? The patient clearly is having some symptoms, and not terrible symptoms, but it sounds like fairly significant symptoms, yet wants to avoid chemo.
And he's had no chemotherapy to date? Is that
no, he had been on, you know, the obvious combined androgen blockade, bicalutamide withdrawal, then was on abiraterone, prednisone versus prednisone alone trial, then briefly went on radium trial, which is also a randomized trial.
But no chemo.
And no chemo, got a little dexamethasone. Now he's getting more symptomatic, his LDH is up, PSA is starting to go on up.
Yeah, it's a humbling disease state. A guy who's now symptomatic is very unlikely to remain in status quo for long, and it is someone you begin to encourage to do something proactive about. And this would seem to me to be the right time frame to initiate chemotherapy. And so it becomes a conversation about what patients are willing to tolerate. I think a common perception that patients have is sort of like chemotherapy now and forever versus chemotherapy never, but that's not the real conversation. It's a matter of, you know, we're going to give this a try. We'll see how well it works. We'll see how well you tolerate it, and we'll continue it as long as it makes sense.
You know, getting back to the point I made before about median survivals, patients really perseverate over median survivals, and, you know, perhaps Oliver's patient is saying, well, I read from the internet, it only prolongs my survival by 2 or 3 months. And that's kind of what the perception is in exchange for toxicity. And I think we have to try to get people over that median survival. Median survival for us is, did the drug work? What it means for the individual is very different. And you have to talk through the risks and benefits and whether or not it's appropriate for that patient at that time. But I agree that this is a patient who should have that discussion.
I mean, one of the really underappreciated issues, docetaxel is one of the most effective anti-cancer therapies we have in terms of symptom improvement. We all take care of these patients. It's very dramatic. It's typically after a single cycle. Patients come back. They feel better. Their pain is better. And trying to get that point across in terms of its impact on quality of life is actually a pretty critical issue.
So, Oliver, do you agree that we have the evidence base from clinical trials to support what Bob just said?
Absolutely.
What specifically?
Well, in the original TAX-327 study, there were quality of life parameters. This was published back in 2004 in New England Journal. And it was pretty clear that you could have symptom relief with docetaxel use. Now, prednisone was being introduced concomitantly, and there was also some prophylactic oral dexamethasone as well. And I think, quite frankly, all three of those together contribute to the efficacy. But nevertheless, you can get symptom relief. I've seen it in a practical way for many years.
So if this man were to say, and maybe he did say to you, what's your best guess in terms of how I'm going to be feeling in a few months, better, worse, or the same?
I would tell him that I think he's going to be doing better, and we're going to have to work on the side effects of chemotherapy, and I'm going to carefully counsel him on those. But this is a patient who I think would benefit from chemotherapy. And if you look at my case, I made at that point a strong recommendation. You need to start on chemotherapy.
So we'll do a real quick with a medical oncologist here, one of these things. I want to know specifically which regimen you'd give to him. What would you give or what did you give?
I'd use docetaxel, FDA approved, 75 milligrams per meter squared.
Same.
There you go. What about steroids, incidentally, prednisone?
You know, it's really kind of interesting. The whole prednisone issue has been going on a long time. We know it has a little activity. It can modulate PSA and pain. Ian Tannick published a study back in 89. I published some studies on PSA back in the 90s. And dexamethasone has been utilized in Royal Marsden studies to show that it has real activity. So I think it's an important component of the therapy, and I do use it.
So in this patient, would you use it or not?
Yes.
Symptomatic patients, yes.
I don't give any dexamethasone, but I treat every patient with prednisone at 10 milligrams, and I frankly think that the risk-benefit ratio is unequivocally in terms of benefit. I'm treating symptomatic patients.
Most of these patients have been treated with steroids in prior regimens and have probably gained the benefit, in my mind, of whatever anti-tumor effect it has, and it does have an anti-tumor effect. So if a person has seen prednisone before, steroids before, and other regimens, which is likely the case, I do not give prednisone along with docetaxel.
Let's carry this case out. You know, let's finish.
So he starts on the docetaxel, 75 milligrams per meter squared. And first of all, he tolerates it better than he expected. I think his expectations for chemotherapy had been around other patients who had fared poorly but with other regimens, and that's, you know, people confuse cancers. They think every cancer is like pancreatic cancer, and it's not. And they think that every chemotherapy might be like a leukemia patient where you're in the hospital for a month. And he really did better, but he did develop some fatigue and a little diarrhea. We had to put him on a little antidiarrheal medication. But his PSA went up initially after a couple cycles, but then began to trend down, and he was doing better. But then he was complaining about a loss of taste, and that is an issue that arises, I think, more than the literature would really give credence to. And he started getting fatigue, which I thought was chemotherapy associated, and we gave him a little chemotherapy break, you know, see if we can get his taste going a little better, help his fatigue out, and disease is controlled better.
At that point?
6 cycles at that point.
And just out of curiosity, do you see the taste thing also with cabazitaxel?
We do, yeah.
So what happened next with this man?
Well, we kept him off therapy for a couple months and, you know, monitor him. But it was only 2 months later when he starts to have a little more noticeable bone pain and his PSA is starting to rise up again. So I restarted the docetaxel.
What happened?
And he was able to have some symptom improvement again, a little PSA decline. But then after three cycles, he's starting to progress again. And both symptoms and PSA are both beginning to progress.
So, Matt, what would you have been thinking outside of protocol setting for this man, you know, 6 months ago? And how about today?
I think the case described is a very common scenario, initial response, progressive disease within a year. In a patient with bone pain, I think it's a reasonable setting to consider radiopharmaceuticals. As I understand it, he may already have had radium-223, but in the absence of such prior treatment, or even maybe now, I'd consider samarium. With the availability of cabazitaxel, this is the kind of patient that you would consider giving cabazitaxel. Previously, if you're going to consider other systemic chemotherapy, it'd be mitoxantrone.
So let's bring us up to date on what happened with this patient.
So I go ahead and re-scan him. He's got some progressive lesions in his bone. He's got some periaortic nodes that were increasing in size. His performance status is still okay. His chemistries are okay. Liver function, his counts have been holding up reasonably well. Not had febrile neutropenia. And ended up moving on to cabazitaxel. I don't really have enough data right now, but we note that his age is greater than age 65, and we use the upfront GCSF. So we're just starting out. I can't really give you much follow-up beyond that.
How has he evolved in terms of his attitude or feelings about getting chemotherapy?
Much more understanding now because he benefited. And, you know, he was one of those guys who came in, and I mean, he initially told me, he said, I'm not going to go on chemotherapy. And we actually had the radium-223 trial, which you could do for patients who are refusing chemotherapy. Well, he went on. Unfortunately, I think he was on the placebo aspect of that trial. He really didn't seem to have any discernible benefit, and he actually withdrew consent from that trial. He just said, look, I'm not getting better. And I agreed with him. I said, look, you're not getting better with what we're doing. We need to change. So even though he was on the radium-223 trial, I don't think he was getting it. And when we went to the chemotherapy and he got better, he said, oh, okay. And it wasn't as bad as he expected.
Howard, how do you see the perception of chemotherapy for prostate cancer evolving over the last 5 years or so since docetaxel came onto the scene, you know, in terms of how it's utilized by oncologists? And, you know, when you see patients back who've had it, their trials in earlier stage disease, how's your own impression about how this has tolerated evolved over the last 5 years?
Occasionally, I hear reports about how there are men with metastatic hormone-refractory prostate cancer who die from their disease without ever seeing docetaxel once, and I'm always a bit surprised at that. In the kind of academic, multidisciplinary medical centers that I've spent my career, I think it's common and routine to use docetaxel, and I think patients expect it at a certain point in their disease course, and yet perhaps out in the community, they're still a sense that chemotherapy lacks efficacy, or maybe patients have that perception and that prevents them from getting a treatment that I think is really very effective.
Steve?
Just to follow up what Howard said, I think it comes back to that 2 to 3 month median survival, and that's what they hear. So they don't hear the significant pain relief and symptom improvement at the first dose. They say, why should I go on to chemotherapy if it's only going to buy me 2 to 3 months? So I think it's a patient reluctance, as well as physician lack of understanding to a certain degree.
So let's talk about another area where a lot's going on, namely bone-targeted treatment. And Matt, we asked you to present a couple of patients from your practice that illustrate where we're heading.
So our first case is a 74-year-old white man with locally advanced prostate cancer. His clinical stage is T3A-NX. He has Gleason 3+4 in a total of 8 cores. His PSA was 20 at diagnosis. He has imaging tests, including abdominal pelvic CT and bone scan, that demonstrate no detectable metastases. He's a pack-a-day smoker. He drinks 3 alcoholic beverages most days. He has no family history of prostate cancer. His father is deceased. His mother is living in an assisted living facility following a hip fracture. He's 5'10". His weight is 166 pounds. His body mass index is 24.1 kilograms per meter squared.
After consultations with several specialists, he decided to pursue combined modality therapy with androgen deprivation therapy using Goserelin for 3 years and IMRT starting 2 months after initiation of androgen deprivation therapy.
So Howard, his wife says, "Doctor, what about his bones? I've read, you know, that when they get this kind of hormone therapy, you know, maybe they're going to have more fractures. Should he be concerned about it, doctor?"
I would say that anyone who goes on 3 years of hormonal therapy, as Matt described, should have some concern. I think their concern should be elevated, and I don't know whether he's had his bone density assessed, but that would be perfectly appropriate before he started his long course of hormonal treatment.
So would you order a bone density? Would you send him to an endocrinologist? Would you start him on some kind of bone therapy or exercise?
Well, all patients that I start on hormone therapy, I recommend calcium and vitamin D. But for those who are going on long-term hormone therapy, I recommend a baseline bone density. So I would suggest that, and I would order it in his case.
So at least it was okay, you'd say just keep taking your calcium and vitamin D and we'll repeat it again? Or?
Yeah, that's how I would handle it.
So Matt, agree, disagree, or in between with this plan?
So I disagree with that plan, and the reason is I think there's an overemphasis on measurement of bone mineral density as a determinant of fracture risk. There's a variety of well-established clinical risk factors that are strongly associated with risk for fracture, and there's a number of things that come out in this man's history that tell us that he's at particularly high risk for fracture, regardless of bone mineral density. Those include his age, his habits, including smoking and alcohol use, his maternal history of hip fracture. And this is one setting where being thin is undesirable. He's a particularly thin guy who is at greater risk for fracture based on his body mass index.
What about assays, bone turnover, imaging studies, any kind of technology to identify higher risk beyond these sort of clinical factors?
So the point that Howard made about measurement of bone mineral density is a very reasonable recommendation, and that helps further refine the risk for fracture. But the point I'm attempting to make in this case is that what we already know about this man tells us that he exceeds a fracture risk that meets standard guidelines for drug therapy to prevent fractures. And that's separate from his use of androgen deprivation therapy.
So then, agree or disagree, he ought to be started on a bisphosphonate?
He should be started on drug therapy.
Well, does that mean bisphosphonate or a trial?
Well, bisphosphonate, and there's, you know, new information about other drugs that prevent fractures in this setting. Bisphosphonates are known to be effective in a variety of settings, postmenopausal osteoporosis for fracture prevention, for example. But they're likely to prevent fractures in men, although that's never been formally established.
So, Matthew, what's his lifetime risk of having a long bone fracture without androgen deprivation therapy?
Yeah, so I calculated it using what's called the FRAX algorithm. So there's this major effort by the World Health Organization to have region and gender-specific predictors of fracture risk, and these are 10-year probabilities. In doing that, I included androgen deprivation therapy as a secondary cause of osteoporosis, which would really underestimate his true fracture risk, so I didn't do it without that. But with that included, his 10-year probability of hip fracture is 25%.
So that's with androgen deprivation.
Yeah, and if you took again, the FRAX model doesn't specifically account for androgen deprivation therapy. Mm-hmm. There's a way you can score secondary cause of osteoporosis. And in calculating his risk, I recommend that you just score that. But if you were to take that out, his risk for hip fracture would still be something on the order of 20% or something like that.
And that's with calcium and vitamin D administration.
Well, this is from huge meta-analyses. Yeah. You know, some of the patients would and wouldn't.
This might be overestimated because of that. Because as you've
shown, like it's a higher number.
It is
a higher number. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And this was the point I tried to make in this case. So a couple things stand out. He's thin. He's 74. He smokes. He drinks. And his mother broke her hip. Mm-hmm. So these things really drive up his risk. Age being a really robust predictor of fracture risk. But the estimated 25%, I would argue, might actually underestimate his risk because I think androgen deprivation therapy has probably a greater deleterious effect than we can estimate using the FRAX model.
So in terms of what you would say to a patient, for example, what would you say overall in your mind is the impact of bone-targeted therapy, so bisphosphonates, denosumab, agents that have been proven to be helpful, what do you think the impact would be on the wrist fracture, whatever it is?
So his fracture risk would be reduced by about 40% based on the results of the denosumab. fracture prevention trial.
And could you actually go through, first of all, the New England Journal paper that you published? You know, really, to me, that was the first time I start, you know, people were kind of questioning, is this really something clinically meaningful? Particularly, I heard that from urologists. When your paper came out, it was like, Can you go through that paper and then the subsequent work that's been done in this field?
Sure. So I think over time, there's been increasing recognition of the problem of fractures in older men and the fact that androgen deprivation therapy increases that risk. And the unmet medical need was a demonstration of fracture prevention in men receiving androgen deprivation therapy. Prior to that New England Journal of Medicine report, there have been no published fracture prevention studies in standalone fracture prevention studies in men in any setting. And so that was the first. At the time we designed the trial, we had to make a variety of assumptions because we couldn't build upon prior fracture prevention trials. The study included about 1,500 men who were receiving androgen deprivation therapy. We selected men who would be at somewhat increased risk for fracture based on either age greater than 70 years, or if less than 70 years, a T-score of less than minus 1, so that would correspond to a standard definition of osteopenia. And then the subjects were randomized to denosumab every 6 months or placebo for 3 years. All the subjects in the trial received supplemental calcium and vitamin D. And the endpoints for the trial were change in bone mineral density as well as new vertebral fractures.
And what did you find?
We found that there was a robust effect on bone mineral density. Bone mineral density increased significantly all sites in as early as 1 month after initiating therapy. And there was a reduction in new vertebral fractures at 1, 2, and 3 years.
And what was the cost, so to speak, in terms of how it impacted patients? How was it administered? How is it administered currently? How much of an impact on quality of life and risks of complications is there?
Yeah, so this is the same dose and schedule of denosumab that's been evaluated in fracture prevention in postmenopausal women. So it's twice a year subcutaneous injections, fairly convenient, and obviously good patient compliance because of the route of administration. And the drug was well tolerated. There were very few injection site reactions or other adverse effects associated with treatment.
How about ONJ?
There were no cases of ONJ observed in the trial.
In that trial, overall, what do we know about ONJ with denosumab right now compared to zoledronic acid, and how does that vary with schedule administration?
Yeah, it's a great question. So ONJ emerged as an important adverse effect of particularly intravenous bisphosphonate use, and that came to light after approval of zoledronic acid to prevent skeletal-related events in patients with advanced malignancies. This is a condition basically defined as poor healing after dental surgery, can range in severity from very mild to quite life-altering in its seriousness. As there's been recognition of that problem, the rates appear to have declined because there's better recognition of it and greater prophylaxis, better management by clinicians, dentists, oral surgeons. The pathophysiology is not well understood, and I think the leading hypothesis is that the accumulation of bisphosphonates in the bone, particularly in the jaw, were the cause of ONJ. And it was thought that denosumab, because it doesn't accumulate in bone, may lack that adverse effect. With the SRE prevention trials, where the drug is given at a much higher dose and schedule than in the fracture prevention studies, ONJ has been observed at similar rates, if not slightly higher than that with zoledronic acid. So I think it tells us a lot about pathophysiology, and it suggests that potent osteoclast inhibition by any mechanism will increase the risk of ONJ.
Can you go over again how exactly denosumab and the bisphosphonates work?
So I'll focus on denosumab. So denosumab targets receptor activator of NF-kappa-B ligand or RANK ligand. And one of the most important advances in bone biology in general has been recognition of the RANK-RANK ligand pathway in normal and pathologic skeletal disease states. So most of the normal signals that impact bone metabolism do so by signaling through osteoblasts, and then in turn, osteoblasts communicate with osteoclasts, and then there's this feedback loop between the two. In the past, it was not at all well understood how osteoblasts and osteoclasts communicated, and it's now clear that the RANK-RANK ligand pathway is the critical mediator of osteoblast-osteoclast interactions. And with that recognition, RANK ligand became a therapeutic target to reduce osteoclast function and survival. and denosumab emerged as a potent way of inhibiting osteoclast activity and inducing osteoclast apoptosis.
Any interest in or have the two drugs been combined?
It's not yet been done, to my knowledge. I think it's probably unnecessary for most patients, and we would be concerned about, there's been a theoretical concern about oversuppression of bone, and if that were to be a real problem, that certainly might be a good way to evaluate that. The intriguing things, though, even with the potent drugs like zoledronic acid, and we see this 80% inhibition of osteoclast activity, if you look at a patient-based level, we fail to normalize bone markers in about 20% of patients, say, with prostate cancer. And that probably accounts for why a more potent drug like denosumab was able to show superiority against zoledronic acid.
So getting back to this patient then, Steve, putting aside cost and reimbursement, just at a pure risk-benefit ratio, I don't know if you want more information from Matt in terms of what we know about this, but if you could give either denosumab or zoledronic acid to this patient, would you offer it to him?
The answer is yes. I mean, unfortunately, denosumab is not on the market right now. So options would be either an oral bisphosphonate, which is not always the easiest tolerated, an IV bisphosphonate, where it's difficult to really adjust the dosing. As Matthew had said, with the lower dose denosumab, the risk of ONJ is extremely small. There was none seen in the trial worldwide. There's now 3 cases out of the thousands and thousands of people that have been treated. But when you look at Zometa, which would be our usual IV bisphosphonate, it's a little bit more difficult. You have to worry about renal toxicity. It's an IV infusion, so it's difficult to give in a urology practice. So if denosumab were on the market, the dose you'd give is a low dose once every 6 months. That would be my treatment of choice. And he would, based upon age over 70, forgetting the fact that he's thin, he's white, he smokes, he drinks, his mother had a hip fracture, which all put him at higher risk. Based upon age over 70 alone, he would have qualified for Matthew's denosumab study.
So just to be clear, though, right now, if a protocol wasn't available to this man, he was your patient, would you either administer zoledronic acid or refer him to somebody to get it?
I would probably talk to him about it, but I wouldn't be aggressive about it at this point.
How about you, Matt? What did you do?
So I think it's worth putting the fracture risk in context. So I don't think we should or can currently reinvent the wheel about precisely defining fracture risk during androgen deprivation therapy or establishing prostate cancer-specific cutoffs for treatment. But the World Health Organization has helped a lot with the FRAX algorithm. National Osteoporosis has guidelines about preventing fractures in older men, and that's become part of the NCCN guidelines in prostate cancer management. So the NOF recommends drug therapy for patients who have a personal history of a vertebral or hip fracture, a femoral neck T-score of less than minus 2.5, so a diagnosis of osteoporosis, or a FRAX 10-year probability of a hip fracture of greater than 3% or any major osteoporotic fracture of 20%. And we've already discussed in this patient, his risk for hip fractures was estimated at 25%. So he is presented as an example to provide what I think is a clear candidate for drug therapy. And without a doubt, I would treat this patient currently with a bisphosphonate, and when available, I would prefer to use denosumab.
So what did you actually do with the person?
So I found that oral bisphosphonates are very poorly tolerated. There's a high rate of patient discontinuation because of gastrointestinal toxicity. And these are patients I would typically treat with annual zoledronic acid.
And where is he right now?
So he's continuing his adjuvant androgen deprivation therapy, and he receives annual zoledronic acid. He's tolerated it well.
Are you repeating his bone density?
So these are patients who required at least 3 years of hormone therapy. These are, of course, patients who are at risk for subsequent failure and needing more hormone therapy later. So I do like to measure their baseline bone mineral density, and in someone like this, I would probably repeat it at once at 2 years, and provided it's stable or increasing, I wouldn't have much need to repeat it again in the future. I do not propose that every patient who goes on androgen deprivation therapy would require some drug to prevent fractures, because many, if not most, of those patients are in fact at low risk for fracture and would not require drug therapy. For those who do meet, say, for example, National Osteoporosis Foundation guidelines for treatment, then it becomes a matter of choice of which drug. And personally, I would prefer to, if your intention is to prevent fractures, I would prefer to use the drug that has the greatest strength of data for fracture prevention. And at the present time, that's denosumab, you know, if and when it becomes commercially available for that approved use.
Oliver?
You know, it's kind of interesting. I saw 2 patients this past week. And you know what I did? I referred them out. No, I'm an oncologist, and I manage prostate cancer, and I do that, you know, probably too much in my day. And when we end up with all these fracture things, so one of the guys was a 80-plus-year-old fellow who had had significant vertebral fractures. I said, you need to see an endocrinologist. You need to see somebody who's going to follow this and take care of your bones. You know, I'll take care of the prostate. And I'm not trying to abdicate responsibility. The other fellow I saw had a T-score minus 3.1 in his hip. And, you know, I hate to say it, I don't want to get overly involved in managing this osteoporosis and fracture risk. I've got cancer to manage. Now, the SRE story is a little bit different. I mean, that's clearly in my domain. But it used to be I might kind of take responsibility. I'm actually referring these patients out more today.
I like your candor, as always, Dr. Sartor, but I think we've got to give Dr. Dreiser an opportunity to comment on that kind of, I'd say, slightly controversial statement.
So I think that the spectrum of ADT use and the toxicities, I mean, we're urologic oncologists that work in a world where the Europeans look at our practice of over-treatment of this disease with ADT, right? So we're talking about specific issues, but the massive use of ADT in the United States is in biochemical failure. And that's the sort of interesting dilemma. If we were only going to limit this discussion to these kind of patients, locally advanced patients who are getting defined use of ADT, it would be a nice theoretical discussion. We're not going to spend a lot of money. The problem is that in clinical practice, the people that are most worried about this are people getting ADT indefinitely for biochemical failure. So it's a very interesting dynamic in which we as a universe of clinicians have opted to say we're going to treat patients with ADT for prolonged periods without data demonstrating its utility, and then we're going to develop therapeutics to deal with the toxicities in bone and other places of ADT. And that's really, you know, when clinicians ask me about this, they're asking about that setting. They're not so much asking about defined use of ADT.
So, oncologists of America driving along the road, go to the web and see Dr. Smith's excellent slide presentation on this topic. But Matt, can you comment on earlier use of bone-targeted treatment and the issue of whether these agents might actually prevent disease progression independent of bone-targeting effects?
So we have the two spectrums, prevention of treatment-related morbidity, fractures, and the other spectrum of treating serious disease-related morbidity of so-called skeletal-related events, pathologic fractures and pain and spinal cord compression. But in between, there's this very large gulf of metastasis prevention, and that does remain a major unmet medical need. There's a big disparity in the fields where, you know, breast cancer, there's several well-done positive trials demonstrating bone metastasis prevention. And to date, there's been no adequate trial completed for metastasis prevention in prostate cancer.
Although there was one really interesting presentation out of the UK at ASCO in myeloma, where they compared zoledronic acid to cladronate and saw a survival advantage with zoledronic acid, which made everybody think about the breast cancer trials. When are we going to have an answer to this in prostate cancer?
So the new information should be forthcoming soon. There are two trials that are ongoing of specific bone-targeted therapies for metastasis prevention. There's a ZEUS trial of zoledronic acid in Europe, patients with high-risk primary disease with zoledronic acid versus placebo for 4 years with an outcome of time to bone metastases. And then there's the global denosumab 147 trial of metastasis prevention in patients with castration-resistant non-metastatic disease with the primary outcome of bone metastasis-free survival.
So I actually want to go on to your next case, which kind of gets to the second aspect of sort of what we wanted to talk about here, if you could present him.
So the second case is a 78-year-old man with castration-resistant metastatic prostate cancer. He has disease that involves periaortic nodes and extensive bone metastases. In early 2008, he entered a clinical trial comparing zoledronic acid versus denosumab. Shortly thereafter, he initiated docetaxel. He was treated for about 9 months. His best response was stable disease. In June 2009, he reinitiated docetaxel but discontinued for disease progression. And then when the results of the denosumab trial showed superiority against zoledronic acid, in early 2010, he began open-label treatment with DMAB.
What was the mechanism that he got it? Is it through a trial or how?
Yeah, so denosumab is not approved for any cancer indication yet. The results of several large pivotal studies have been reported, and the biologic license application for use in this setting has been filed. It's received
priority review, and the PDUFA date is in November 2010.
So how did he get it?
So he was on a clinical trial.
He was on a trial.
He was on the so-called denosumab 103 trial, which was the SRE prevention study in prostate cancer. And then when the results showed superiority of denosumab, all subjects were offered the option of crossing over to open-label treatment.
So can you talk about what we know about bone-targeted agents, including denosumab, in this sort of clinical space?
So there's currently one approved therapy to prevent skeletal-related events, these complications that arise due to bone metastases. It's zoledronic acid. The drug was approved in 2002 after demonstrating superiority against placebo in that setting. With the development of denosumab, a RANK ligand-targeted therapy, a phase 3 trial was designed comparing to the current standard zoledronic acid with the same primary outcome of skeletal-related events. So it's a large undertaking, about 2,000 patients, with non-inferiority study design. The study met its primary endpoint. It was non-inferiority and, in fact, proved superior to zoledronic acid for prevention of skeletal-related events, and on that basis has been filed for approval. There are no other drugs in development that I'm aware of with that same endpoint. There are other bone-targeted therapies of considerable interest. Steve mentioned zibotentan, an endothelin 1 receptor antagonist that's being evaluated in several phase 3 trials in advanced prostate cancer. There are studies of radiopharmaceuticals in this setting, radium-223, with an endpoint of survival in castration-resistant metastatic disease. So there's a lot of activity in this space.
What sort of hazard ratio or relative risk reduction roughly do you obtain with denosumab over
18%?
0.18.
Isn't everything always 20%?
And it's actually remarkably consistent when they did three trials, breast cancer, a prostate, and a non-breast, non-prostate.
Right.
And pretty much was about 18. One, I think, was 16. One was 17. I mean, it's pretty consistent, about 18% across all three.
Matt, what's your take in terms of what denosumab seems to be bringing to the table?
There are several potential advantages. One is the route of administration. There's no renal toxicity, so it doesn't even require renal function monitoring for treatment. There have been hopes that they would lack the problem of osteonecrosis of the jaw. As we've already discussed, that is not the case. It has a similar rate of ONJ to zoledronic acid.
One of the elephants in the room, though, which we haven't talked about, is duration of therapy. You know, clinicians always are asking the question in the current context of zoledronic acid is how long? When
sure.
do you stop? When do you? And the same issue is going to basically arise irrespective of the compounds that we're using in terms of disease progression, when you have events, and even with denosumab, which compared to zoledronic acid in terms of secondary SREs was positive. But at some point in time, there's going to be a question if you have seven new drugs to add on in a world where cipulucil T is evolved is how long, how much?
And also, and I don't know how this is going to play out, if it does finally flesh out, we get the data, we figure it out, or yeah, it's going to have 20% fewer, one, a pretty small number, you know, how much are we going to be willing to pay for it, either individually or as a society, if it turns out it costs more?
Well, that was the Tanak issue at ASCO, where he made the point that there's no survival advantage, the cost is going to be significantly more, and many of the skeletal-related events may not be clinically relevant. Now, that's an arguable point, but that was, you know, he said, well, maybe so what on some of these skeletal-related events? And he made the point on, and again, I would be interested in Dr. Smith's counter comment, that some of these were vertebral, minor vertebral fractures, where that may not be that relevant.
More on imaging than clinically.
Right.
Matt?
That's an excellent point. So skeletal-related events are really clinical trial jargon. They're not a clinical problem of their own. They're clinical trial jargon. They arose in the original bisphosphonate development plan in cancer. And they're meant to capture the problems that result from bone metastases, most of which are painful. So the events in this composite endpoint include radiation to bone, pathologic fractures, surgery to bone, and spinal cord compression. Now, the point that you're referring to is the fractures, so-called pathologic fractures, are, for the most part, radiographically assessed. So there are serial skeletal surveys done as a part of these trials. And many of the so-called pathologic fractures are radiographically assessed and may not be symptomatic. So this was a part of the original zoledronic acid study design. In comparing to an existing drug, there was no option but to retain the same endpoint. But I think it's a very fair criticism that all parts of the endpoint are not the same. We can all agree that spinal cord compression is a bad thing. I think most of us would agree, even Howard, that radiation to bone is a bad thing, and not that the radiation is bad, and that it's being done for reasons of pain. So I think that is a very reasonable point to make.
Phil?
I think we all believe that the agent is a stronger agent than zoledronic acid. The question that remains in my mind is that clinically significant? And I think these hazard ratios are such that they're kind of on the fence. You know, when 0.18 to me with endpoints, as Matthew pointed out, that are probably important with so few events, the question is this enough to make us change our practice? And I guess I'm still on the fence about it myself. I think what will change the field dramatically is the studies that Matthew is leading, looking at metastasis prevention. If those studies are positive, I think those will be game changers. These studies, to me, still on the fence about.
Yeah, I mean, you see relative risk reduction with aromatase inhibitors and breast cancer, tamoxifen at 20%. Everybody does it because the event you're avoiding is recurrence. And so, you know, maybe when the research shows that, 20% is going to mean a lot more. Steve?
A couple thoughts here. I mean, I think we need to separate the fracture risk from the SRE, because as Matthew pointed out, they're very different. And I think the fracture data event rate is relatively low. It's predominantly radiographic. And I think the clinical relevance has been and will continue to be debated. I think for the SREs, when you look at the data from the denosumab 103 study, a lot of these patients are getting skeletal-related events. It's not a couple percent. I mean, median time to an event is about 10, 12 months. And the rate at 1-2 years is 50% of these patients are getting SREs. And thanks to, I think, your work, Phil, and your work, Oliver, survival is getting longer and longer because we have effective cancer therapies. Cipollucel T, cabazitaxel. So survival gets longer. I think we're going to see even higher rates of SREs because people are living longer to develop it. So I think it is a common endpoint in that setting. I agree the efficacy is there. We can debate 18%. It is effective. But one of the things, and maybe Matthew can comment on, if you look at the Zometa data, the Fred Saw JNCI paper, the number one SRE was radiation to the bone. Far and away, that was the number one SRE, which is pain. I mean, as a surrogate of pain, and again, it's not that the radiation is bad, but you're doing it for pain. So to me, you are, even though the data hasn't been looked at that way, you're improving quality of life. So that you're not necessarily improving quantity of life, but quality of life. And then it does come down to, well, is that worth the cost? And I mean, you get into the macroeconomics of it all.
John?
Well, that's a great point about cost. I mean, if you think about societal costs, you know, obviously there's a criticism potentially of the medical therapies being expensive. But on the other hand, how much does a course of palliative radiotherapy to the bone cost? And I mean, that would be an interesting, has anyone done any kind of economic analysis if you prevent an episode of radiotherapy to the bone versus 2 or 3 years of denosumab, et cetera? How would that play out from a cost standpoint?
I think, Judd, one of the things that's interesting is that, and I would be interested in my colleagues' experience, is that several of us in this room have been taking care of prostate cancer patients for a long time. The amount of patients who I give external beam radiotherapy for palliation has dropped considerably over the last 5 to 10 years as our systemic therapies get better, because in many instances, in an era prior to docetaxel, palliative radiotherapy was relatively commonly utilized. In my patients now who present with emerging disease-related symptoms that are not acute, not spinal cord lesions or epidural disease, frequently systemic therapy is administered and, frankly, is a very effective way of palliating bone. So it's not just, so you're right, but the issue now is as we evolve systemic therapies, they get better, especially the ones that have objective anti-tumor activity. So unlike the immunomodulatory therapy, the systemic agents with direct anti-tumor activity, it's likely to be a different landscape. And I think that the interesting issue about the asymptomatic fracture is that many of us have lectured many places, and I routinely ask groups frequently made up of community oncologists and urologists, how many of you have seen what you think is an ADT-related fracture? And usually in a room of 100 people, one arm goes up. Now, that's obviously you have to look for it to find it. or it has to be clinically relevant enough to see it. So I think all of these issues go forward in an era where we're spending a lot of money on therapy and trying to, you know, the Canadians, because of their nature of their practice, tend to be more pragmatic about these issues. And it may be that we have to begin to think about the universe of therapy and the impact on the patient as opposed to try to module it out.
I accept the premise of the point you're making, which is that in advanced disease in particular, it's really the disease-related complications that dominate the landscape. And in that setting of the most egregious disease, treatment-related complications are a relatively minor concern. But I do have to take on the point of 1 in 100 clinicians have seen a fracture in their patients, because that completely defies national statistics about fracture rates in the general population. So unless you're proposing that our treatments are actually protective against fractures, that experience is just completely inconsistent with
what's going on. And I don't disagree at all. My point about that is not to suggest that that observation is accurate in terms of number, but it is reflective of what clinicians think about in terms of their patients. So
I accept that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true. Because as soon as you said that, I said, okay, his blood pressure is going to be going up. This is the truth. And particularly in urologists, you know, you get that response. Why are we even thinking about this? It's just not that common a problem.
My resting pulse is 40.
His pulse and blood pressure.
What actually are the numbers? What are the numbers you would give in that situation in terms of ADT? I mean, in terms of what the risk of fracture
is? So if you ask the question to 100 clinicians who have seen a fracture, we cannot assign in an individual patient whether it occurred due to ADT or not, but 100 arms should go up. There isn't a single person who actually sees patients who cannot have seen a fracture in their patients. Now, I have to say that most prostate cancer survivors do not call their urologist if they break their hip, or any other fracture for that matter. But fractures are common. The disease-related complications in the worst of the disease are much more serious. But the hope, in a way, right, is what we're doing with more effective systemic therapies is to make this more of a chronic disease, even in the fatal forms of prostate cancer, which ultimately makes the issues of survivorship more important because patients are going to live longer and, as a consequence, be at greater risk for treatment-related side effects.
70-year-old man's your patient and is about to get ADT, and he says, what's the chance I'm going to have a fracture over the next 5 years with and without this treatment?
So I can give you the 10-year rates better, but so at 10 years, no other risk factors,
right,
and a good bone mineral density. His risk for a hip fracture is 1 or 2% in 10 years, and with ADT, it would be increased by as much as 30 to 50% above that.
Relatively.
Relative risk. So the absolute risk in a healthy 70-year-old is quite low. And this is why I made the clear point earlier that not every patient requires treatment to prevent fractures, even during ADT. And that's just thoughtful patient selection. Thankfully, other groups have made this easy for us. And by that, I'm again referring to the National Osteoporosis Foundation guidelines and World Health Organization guidelines.
So, Bob, can you comment a bit on some of the other advances that are being made in systemic treatment, specifically in terms of endocrine therapy and the use of novel agents? And maybe we can start with endocrine treatment.
One of the things that's changed a lot over the last maybe 5 to 10 years has been a dramatic improvement in the understanding of the androgen receptor and the biology associated with the AR. I mean, the example in GU oncology is that when that similar appreciation with VHL happened in kidney cancer, the explosion of targeted therapeutics that were downstream to that target happened. So in prostate cancer, AR is the holy grail. And there have been compounds out there for a long time. And abiraterone is a classic example. Abiraterone is not a new compound. It's been around for a long time. But it's been sort of the co-joining of the improvement of the understanding of that compound and the molecular biology of the AR that led to, you know, some smart folks, including our colleague Dr. DeBona in England, to basically start looking therapeutically at these compounds. So lyase inhibitors, and abiraterone is the lead compound. There are several others in development. Because the pathways are relatively well understood. The concept of testosterone suppression obviously has been a paradigm for 70 years. It wasn't a leap of faith to begin to see reasonably dramatic direct anti-tumor activity of these new generation of compounds to say, hey, there's something going on here. And the whole paradigm of thinking about testosterone suppression and what that really means and the concept of castration-resistant disease, all of that is sort of coming together, and we have several compounds now that are actually able to target in a very straightforward way, meaning we understand mechanistically, for the most part, what's going on. And okay. That includes second-generation antiandrogens.
And now it's time for you to explain that. So if you could just sort of take that, just like we did before with some of these other strategies, if you could talk a little bit about sort of how you understand the hormonal milieu and then how agents like abiraterone, TAC 700, and MDB 3100 work, and also what a lyase inhibitor is.
So CYP17 is the enzyme pathway in the sort of testosterone pathway, ACTH, all the way downstream. And if you think about old drugs, including ketoconazole, we've known that ketoconazole act as a CYP17 inhibitor. It wasn't particularly effective, but we saw clinical activity.
What is CYP17?
CYP17 inhibits some of the conversion pathways from ACTH down through testosterone. It inhibits a specific part of the pathway.
It's an enzyme.
It's an enzyme, so it's much higher.
So it's an enzyme that you end up having less or more adrenal androgens as it's turned on.
If you inhibit conversion, you decrease
adrenal
and sometimes
androgens.
You increase, depending on where the pathway occurs. So with regards to the target of the lyase inhibitors, what you're really trying to do ultimately is to decrease what you wind up at the end, DHT and the internal process, not only from a peripheral level, but also at a cellular level in terms of moving into the nucleus. So now, ultimately, that's what you're trying to do, is turn it off.
Is CYP17 a lyase?
So the CYP17 enzyme complex, these are...
Complex, okay.
You can refer to them as lyase. And lyase inhibitor is a drug that inhibits that enzymatic process
of
conversion.
Got it. So just in terms of mechanism of action, what is TAC 700 and how does that compare to abiraterone?
It's a different chemical structure of a molecule that basically does the same thing. The difference is that the enzyme, the CYP17 dual complex has different impact depending on where in the pathway it impacts. And these are somewhat different, perhaps, abiraterone and TAC 700 in terms of that level of activity at different parts of the conversion pathway.
Judd?
You know, from a very simplistic standpoint, I've heard people at meetings talk to community physicians saying that abiraterone is like a more effective, less toxic ketoconazole, and that MDV-3100 is like bicalutamide on steroids. Now, that's... Mm-hmm. But I don't know, is that oversimplifying it for a community-based practitioner?
That's about right. It just, many folks may not understand how ketoconazole works. It's partly because the biology is complex, as you've appreciated.
Including me, so just tell us, add it out on the table. How does it work?
So Rob is right. I completely agree. It inhibits an enzyme lyase. There's also another enzyme hydroxylase, part of the same complex. And these drugs inhibit in different ratios one enzyme in that complex versus the other, and therefore that ratio modulates both its efficacy as well as the side effect profile. So a drug like ketoconazole also inhibits lyase and hydroxylase, but it has a lot of other collateral inhibitory effects and has a lot more side effects than does abiraterone.
And it may not be as potent in terms of the inhibition that we want.
I think certainly it isn't as potent. Right. And an issue that hasn't been resolved is whether ketoconazole works as effectively in the different sites that we mentioned, including the testicles, the adrenals, and the tumor, as opposed to abiraterone or, for that matter, the other compounds.
TAC 700.
TAC 700 or the TOCI compound. So all those fine issues remain to be determined, but the general concept of inhibiting lyase CYP17 is the central focus for this class of compounds, as opposed to, as Judd mentioned before, MDV-3100, which is a completely different class of compounds, which inhibits directly the androgen receptor, I think Rob is going to talk about, which seems to be more effective than bicalutamide.
So let's just talk briefly about the clinical data we have on these agents, beginning with abiraterone.
Well, briefly, abiraterone has gone through a fair extensive phase 1-2 experience in patients with castrate-resistant metastatic disease without chemotherapy, having received ketoconazole post-chemotherapy. I think suffice it to say, oral, relatively well-tolerated, objective activity, intriguing sort of levels of anti-tumor activity in terms of both objective disease as well as PSA.
Do you give steroids with it?
So interestingly enough, so in the trials, there have been trials done with and without. If you ask Dr. DeBono and you want to really get him upset and you make the statement, you must give abiraterone with steroids, he gets unglued and gets angry. And there's actually a letter in JCO sort of speaking to that. So the reality is some of the side effect issues are managed with steroids. We don't know whether or not you need to give steroids in everyone. We don't know if we need to give the dose and the type of steroids we're giving. But suffice it to say, for purposes of clinical development, prednisone was administered with abiraterone.
And what is this new study that's going to be reported?
So two large trials, which have long since been completed, took patients with castrate-resistant metastatic disease progressing on docetaxel, randomized to abiraterone pred versus pred, and a pre-chemotherapy trial of a similar design. This trial that is going to be reported at ESMO is the survival study in the post-docetaxel setting. And that's what we're going to see here. This is the definitive registration trial.
And it sounds like this from this press release that it's going to be positive.
It sounds like that a lot.
That happens all the time now, you know?
Well, I mean, in part, obviously, from the context of having to do due diligence with the Securities and Exchange Commission and the timing, there's no other major meetings until March. They had to present this information shortly after this, and ESMO was the place.
So what about TAC 700? Can you tell us more about it?
So TAC 700 is another compound in class. Mechanistically, it may differ a bit from abiraterone in terms of how it'll be dosed, whether or not it'll need steroids. I think the reality from a practical perspective is its development is significantly behind abiraterone, meaning that you have a randomized trial, it's likely to be presented. The TAC 700 has completed phase 1-2 trials, two large registration trials mirroring the abiraterone experience are going to activate worldwide. It's a challenge when you try to develop a drug that you can't clearly define as to be better than another drug in class.
Any reason to think it'd be either more effective or less side effects?
It has some theoretical possibilities of that. The trials that I just mentioned are not going to speak to any of those issues.
And you were saying that in terms of where abiraterone, let's say these trials end up being very positive, where do you think it's going to be used or where would you use it?
So I guess I would say two quick things. Obviously, there is a similar trial that will be probably reported next year in the pre-chemotherapy setting. If this trial shows a survival benefit, the likelihood is, unless there are commercial reimbursement issues that speak to the use in only the labeled indication, meaning if it was labeled in the post-chemotherapy setting, and if that's not a restriction, we all think that in terms of second-line hormonal therapy, this is the definitive second-line hormonal therapy. So the likelihood is it will move up very early in patients who have biochemical progression on hormones, even though you could argue about that, but certainly in patients with castrate metastatic disease with biochemical progression.
You think it'll bump ketoconazole out?
Ketoconazole is done. Okay.
Interesting. Let's kind of bring this a little bit more into reality. I'm going to ask you to present your case.
So this is a 76-year-old gentleman who presented in the early 90s with good wrist disease. He underwent primary radiotherapy with external beam. In 2001, he had, with PSA progression, biopsy-proven persistent disease, was taken to a salvage prostatectomy. 4 years later, he presented with bone metastasis, was treated with combined androgen blockade, did well until the summer of 2009, when he had biochemical progression with new metastasis. At that time, he had some mild bone pain, his appetite and weight were stable, and his performance status was reasonable. He was enrolled on a phase 1-2 trial of TAC 700. His nadir PSA on study was 0.06. He remains on study without evidence of clinical or radiographic progression approaching 13 months with really minimal side effects of therapy.
Do you think he had a response to the treatment?
Oh, unequivocally.
And any thoughts in terms of where you think this might be heading? If he, you know, does develop progressive disease, what would be the next therapy you'd like to think about?
Well, the reality is that this patient has obviously not seen other systemic therapies. I mean, for me, I would like him to hang on long enough to get any number of compounds that we're looking in, the castrate, metastatic, relatively asymptomatic state. So my hope for him is to be able to enroll him on a series of trials. Ultimately, he'll see other therapies, whether it be systemic chemotherapy, if he remains asymptomatic, if he's interested in cipulucil T, etc. But the reality is that this gentleman has demonstrated, I think, the optimal utility of lyase inhibition in terms of real, true secondary responses.
I'd say also, Judge, has demonstrated the value of sending somebody to a medical oncologist vis-a-vis the model we were talking about before, which is you have a window where you can use new agents, and in this case, this man benefited.
So just to comment on, you know, this guy got TAK 700 and has been stable for like 13 months, I guess, with just that single oral agent. You know, I was in clinic earlier this week with one of my oncology partners, and we're doing one of the MDV-3100 trials. And even though it's blinded, we were sitting in the workroom and one of the research coordinators came in and a whole bunch of people around. And we kind of know what the patient's on because the PSAs are not blinded. And we have a similar case where it's just a dramatic PSA response that went from like 4,000 down to like one. And so, you know, I'm listening there as a urologist and they're all pumped up about it. And I haven't really seen that with too many trials where they're actually really pumped up about these results.
Well, I think all of us, the med oncs here, this is a different paradigm. We've got drugs that actually are starting to do things that you don't have to sort of hallucinate about. They're real drugs.
Yeah.
All right, so getting back to trying to explain pathways to me and the oncologist driving along in their car, let's talk about endothelin A antagonists. How do they work?
Well, endothelin A works at two levels in terms of when you think about prostate cancer. Inhibiting them has direct anticellular activity, and they're also important in terms of the whole mechanism of bone turnover and inhibiting bone metastasis at some theoretical level. In cellular models and animal models, endothelin A inhibition, work done by Joel Nelson and a lot of other folks, have unequivocally been very intriguing. Atrasentan, one of the lead compound in class, has sort of provided 15 years of education for many of the GU medical oncologists here about the difficulty in doing clinical trials in prostate cancer, the issues of trying to do studies of drugs that you think may be bone drugs versus anti-prostate cancer drugs in that whole milieu. I think suffice it to say that there's a lot of intriguing evidence that would suggest that these compounds are static, are important, but demonstrating them clinically has been very, very difficult.
What's the difference between atrasentan and zibutentan?
Two different compounds with somewhat different levels of endothelin A inhibition, but you know they're not dramatically different compounds.
What do we know about both of them clinically?
Well, atrasentan has, again, it's approaching 15 years. We know the toxicity is well. It's relatively well tolerated oral. It has some classic side effects.
What are they?
It tends to be sort of nasal congestion, headache, a little bit of fatigue, those kinds of things, which trouble some people more than others.
How about side effects of zibutentan?
It's same class effect issues.
And does it fall into the category of major problem, nuisance, or sort of how much of a problem is it?
I would say that the majority of patients, it's nuisance. Minor number of patients, it's just not tolerable for a small subset of patients. In general, it's tolerable for most patients.
And usually the most prominent complaint?
Would be nasal congestion.
Nasal congestion, does it respond to decongestants?
A little bit, not really. You really can't overcome. Those patients who are troubled by it the most, they just sort of have to live with it.
And again, what clinical data we have on zibutentan?
Well, so there's a large multi-center international phase 3 program. How they got there was a randomized phase 2, which actually speaks to what Phil was talking about earlier, in which castrate metastatic patients in a randomized phase 2 where you saw no impact on progression-free survival, but that there was a suggestion, obviously, in a non-powered endpoint of survival. That led to a very, very large phase 3 development program.
And what's the design of that study?
Well, there are three trials. There's a non-metastatic trial, so biochemical progression, randomized trial. There is a...
That's by itself?
Correct. There's a metastatic castrate-resistant, relatively asymptomatic pre-chemotherapy randomized trial, and then there's a docetaxel with or without zibotitan randomized trial. These are all international phase 3 trials that are ongoing.
And when are we projecting any of them reporting?
Two of the trials may complete accrual over the next 12 to 18 months. One is much longer.
They've actually the pivotal one, you know, zibotentan versus placebo in traditional castrate-resistant prostate cancer closed to enrollment about close to a year ago, and we're expecting unblinded results in December of this year. The zibotentan with docetaxel also completed enrollment, and we're expecting results on that first or second quarter of 11. The third trial, the biochemical-only castrate-resistant prostate cancer, has been a little bit slow to accrue, although it's on track again. They've made an international global effort to really try to crank up interest and enrollment, and it's actually back on track. and likely will be finished enrollment in December of 2010. So all three trials will be successful as far as their enrollment, and we should know. The one comment I would make is that when you look at, you know, Joel Nelson gets credit for the basic science for this, but when you look at the atrasentan trials, many people thought that the reason they failed was not a long enough exposure to the drugs. You know, as Dr. Dreiser mentioned,
the first issue that Judd's referring to is that one of the large trials, bone imaging was mandated at a relatively frequent interval, as was relatively standard. And the problem is that, as we've now subsequently learned, assessment and pulling people off study because of changes in bone scan caused the large atrasentan trial to basically have dramatic underexposure to compound and may have impacted on its interpretation.
About one half the patients came off at the first assessment at 12 weeks in the atrasentan.
And why was that?
Because of changes in bone.
Because of progression.
Because one of the major contributions of the Prostate Cancer Working Group 2 algorithm was to change that particular assessment to having requirements for multiple changes in bone scan confirmed. This trial was not designed that way. So there were changes in bone scan, which were called progression, and required many patients at their first assessment to come off the study, therefore dramatically impacting
them. I would point out, though, that the Prostate Cancer Working Group 2 criteria have not been validated. And so I would be loath to conclude that it's an improvement yet.
So fair, that's actually a very fair point. Very fair point.
And, you know, in the ZD4054 Zebo-1010 phase 2 trial, the survival benefit was 7 months. Now, granted, it was a randomized phase 2. It was a secondary endpoint. But nevertheless, that survival signal of 7 months is what prompted them to move into the large GLOBE-1-THUS trial, which was the three phase 3 trials. And it's important to point out that the trials are designed to continue exposure to the drug, even if there are progression events. So patients were encouraged to stay on the Zebo-1010 despite clinical progression, with the idea being that longer-term exposure to this class of agents may be beneficial. Now, that's yet to be proven, but we will know fairly soon whether that hypothesis is true.
One of the really interesting things about these set of studies to date is in the atrasentan program, the consistent observation was sort of a modest improvement in time to progression, particularly symptomatic progression, with absolutely no suggestion of a survival benefit. So the results of the small phase 2 randomized trial with absolutely no improvement in time to progression and a suggestion of better overall survival is sort of in complete contrast to the large atrasentan experience. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see the results of the larger ENTHUSE program to see whether that early observation from randomized phase 2 trial is confirmed.
What exactly is endothelin?
So endothelin 1 is a vasoactive peptide. It's thought to be involved, has vascular effects, and is involved in nociception, reception of pain. It's a peptide. It's a small peptide.
Yeah, small peptide. Okay.
It is produced in high levels in the normal prostate and is thought to have a normal reproductive function related to the ejaculate clot. And prostate cancers that arise from the prostate, of course, for whatever reason, make endothelin 1. And that's thought to be part of the pathology of bone metastases, where endothelin 1 is an osteoblast mitogen. So it promotes osteoblasts. So it's thought to be part of the osteoblastic response in metastatic bone disease. So the atrasentan and zebotentan are endothelin A receptor antagonists, which is their endothelin A and endothelin B receptors. And the endothelin A receptor is thought to be the critical part of the pathology in prostate cancer.
And what kind of chemical are they, and how do they actually inhibit endothelin A?
It's a competitive antagonist at the endothelin A receptor.
All right, so my disappointment trial of the year, the BEV study in prostate cancer. Can you briefly talk about the design, the results, and what you think about it?
Randomized U.S. intergroup trial of docetaxel-pred, docetaxel-bevacizumab, bevacizumab given every 3 weeks versus the placebo on the other end. Well done, well-conducted trial. Some improvement in PFS favoring the triplet, the experimental arm. No difference in survival. More toxicity, not unexpectedly associated with the triplet arm. I think, frankly, it's Chris Logothetis one time called bevacizumab the oncomycin, right? So anti-tumor activity in every epithelial cancer. And I think increasingly that is now being discounted as sort of one after another epithelial cancer I think my personal bias on this was that unless there was going to be an unequivocal home run, I think this was actually a good thing for it not to be positive. This is an older population. Bevacizumab is not easy to give in this population. There are lots of issues. And the worst thing I think that could have come from this study was to have a 6-week improvement in survival, sort of mirroring the other solid tumors in which there is activity, and they're increasingly becoming smaller and smaller as the number of diseases where there's robust activity has become less. So I think it's, in the big scheme of things, it's disappointing, but this was always going to be a very difficult disease subset given the age of the population. So I think that we look at it and by saying it's intriguing, does that mean that there is no role for VEGF targeting therapeutics? That's not what this means. But up until now, the sunitinibs of the world, the bevacizumabs of the world, there's not enough activity that we're seeing to sort of justify that development further.
Anybody disagree?
I agree. It's a definitive negative trial for bevacizumab in prostate cancer.
And what's coming, and then there's a VEGF trap trial, which is completed and will be reported probably next year, which one would anticipate not likely to be positive given mechanism. And if that trial is definitively negative, I think that puts this to rest for a while.
You know, one thing maybe to add, and this is a concept I've been thinking about, and I seem to have, you know, maybe noticed a little better in the renal patients I see. When you're giving these type of agents that are VEGF inhibitors, bevacizumab, you know, what they showed was a improvement in PFS. It actually was a pretty impressive PFS. It was 9.9 months, which is very reasonable.
The improvement, but, though, was 2 months.
It was a 2-month improvement. And, right. And yes, I'm, right. I don't yeah. disagree with that. No, I completely agree. It was interesting, though, that after the progression occurred, the deaths seemed to be a little bit squinched down. It seemed like the time between progression and death was a little shorter than I anticipated. And the question is whether or not there's a rebound growth after you take these agents away. And I think I've seen the same thing, in all honesty, in an anecdotal way, for the renal cell patients. We use a variety of the VEGF inhibitors. When you take them away, these tumors seem to sort of spring to life. And I don't know about the proper duration of therapy. You know, we stop the atrasentan at the time of progression. We stop the bevacizumab at the time of progression. I can't help but wonder a little bit what would happen if we'd continue the therapy longer. And that's just a question. I certainly don't have an answer, but that thought has run through my mind several times.
Yeah, they've raised that question in breast cancer too, which obviously recently had the FDA indication pulled, but they saw a very substantial increase in progression-free survival. It was close to a year, no impact in survival, and they postulated the same thing.
Yeah, so I'd like to hear what others think about that possibility.
I think that the TKIs in prostate cancer, in which that's currently being tested in a large trial, I think we'll get a better answer there, but I'm not optimistic that the current class of agents that we have in many ways are obviously sort of very nonspecific.
Let's finish out by discussing the issue of management of the patient with a low Gleason score and which patients need to be treated. Judd, can you present your patient?
So this was a 45-year-old white male software developer from our area who presented with a PSA level of 6.6 in January of 2009. He had a prostate biopsy performed in March of 2009, which revealed a 29cc prostate gland and 3 of 12 cores positive for Gleason 3 plus 3 equals 6 adenocarcinoma. Patient is otherwise healthy with the exception of morbid obesity. He weighs 113.3 kilos, and his body mass index is 41.5.
How tall is he?
He's about 5'6", and definitely a heavy set individual. He had an international prostate symptom score of 1 with a bother score of 0, which basically means he had essentially no lower urinary tract symptoms. And he had an international index of erectile function score of 25, indicating normal sexual function. The interesting twist is he had a wife of 28 years old, and they're currently trying to conceive a child.
So before you go on to what you would do, I'll ask Matt, how would you be thinking through a situation like this?
Yeah, so a number of really striking features about this. So he has low-risk disease, he's particularly young, and then he carries this other serious comorbidity with a BMI of over 40. So we really need to think of this guy as a much older man. I'm sure there's data available that would help inform his life expectancy, but it's very much shorter than that of a typical 45-year-old man. His life expectancy is probably in the 10 to 15-year range with that kind of obesity. And it also presents some practical problems. For example, he may not be a candidate for open prostatectomy. I'll leave it to you to comment on that just based on his body habitus. I'm interested in Howard's view on just even radiating a guy like this with IMRT, whether it's technically feasible it is in a man this size. So you have a number of practical challenges. And then the whole issue of conception is yet another one. So because of the age at which most men are affected by prostate cancer, usually not an issue, but it does come up sometimes in these folks. And so for him, the issue becomes one of really sperm banking before he's treated, because any form of definitive treatment is likely to result in his inability to reproduce.
Matthew, if you think that it's new data to me, you've educated me on risks on bones and life expectancy for somebody with a BMI like this of 10 to 15 years.
I'm not sure about that, but...
Raises the question, of course, if that is the case in this man with Gleason 3+3, we presume, of no treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I'd have to look up that data, but you know, we're not talking about a chubby guy here. You use the term morbidly obese. So he is someone who is seriously ill from obesity and has a much shortened life expectancy. I'd have to look up the data to see if it's as short as I suggested, but this is a big deal. This is far and away. His life-threatening problem is his obesity. And it's not at all clear to me that his prostate cancer diagnosis has any potential to impact his survival. So I think surveillance is something. This is a guy who, despite his young age, I would consider surveillance.
I agree. I mean, if you're looking purely at the cancer point of view, forgetting the morbid obesity, it's not the perfect cancer for surveillance. It's 3 cores. It's a little bit more. His PSA is 6.6 in a 29-gram prostate. So PSA density is about 0.2. And you take into account obesity and the hemodilution of the PSA. His real PSA is probably closer to 8, which gives a PSA density maybe even a 0.3. So again, he doesn't quite fit some of the criteria we use, but I think that's where it's difficult for active surveillance to say, I'm drawing an absolute black and white line in the sand, and one side active surveillance, the other side you need treatment. This is a guy who's at significant risk from comorbidities, but also the treatment itself, particularly a surgical treatment with a BMI of 41, he's at higher risk. Personally, I think it is technically, I have not seen him, but I know we have data from Duke and the VA of men with BMIs of 41 who've undergone surgery. So it's technically possible in the general concept, but it's certainly a significantly higher risk of complications.
How would you approach him, Matt, if he did not have the obesity and had no issues about wanting to have children?
Well, then my preferred treatment is prostatectomy.
What would prompt you to consider active surveillance? What are your criteria?
It basically becomes the issue of how low the risk of his cancer and his projected survival is, best we can do that. But we're talking about a particularly young man. So a guy in his 40s is a dramatic case where, you know, I think the default treatment recommendation is surgery. And I continue to hold that view until someone gets into their 50s. I think in highly selected patients, even in their 50s, you can consider active surveillance. There's well-recognized overdiagnosis problem in the United States in particular. And we see more and more cases of patients with the microscopic focus of cancer in a single core. And that's not a cancer that I'm sure needs to be treated even in men as young as in their 50s.
But in their 40s, you do?
Yes. There are patients as young as this who I've asked for repeat biopsies because literally there's so little cancer that the number of involved glands was enumerated, meaning the pathologist says 6 to 8 abnormal glands consistent with the prostate cancer diagnosis. That's not good enough for me to recommend prostatectomy. And in those patients, I've recommended prompt re-biopsies before proceeding with definitive treatment.
Judd, how do you approach the issue of selecting people for active surveillance?
Well, it's a challenge. And I think that in general, we base it on quantitative histology, their age, their comorbidities, but there's no accepted standard guideline for active surveillance that I'm aware of, and it's subjective. This gentleman, you know, he was seen at our multidisciplinary clinic in April of 2009, where he was seen by a radiation oncologist, a medical oncologist, and a urologist. And because of his desire to conceive a child, we agreed, perhaps reluctantly, to start active surveillance. Now, the other factor that came into play is because of his morbid obesity, he was not an ideal candidate for either open or robotic prostatectomy, and even a radical perineal prostatectomy, which has been the traditional approach back in the day for guys with morbid obesity. that is essentially a non-nerve-sparing operation. And so we would have rendered a 45-year-old guy not only infertile, but impotent. Interestingly, because Dr. Friedland and myself and others at our institution has done some research with the Ari and prostate PX test, we ordered this test commercially on him in May of 2009 in an attempt to better risk assess him for the safety of active surveillance, although in academic fairness, the data on that test is derived from a radical prostatectomy population. So we were using it essentially off-label. We sent 11 paraffin blocks from the original prostate biopsy, and that was done June of 2009. We got a disease progression score of 22. An Ari and PX score of 22 indicates that the patient has a low risk with a 10% probability of disease progression within 8 years after radical prostatectomy. So that was the information that we obtained back from this test. They also gave it a favorable pathology score. And then additionally, the patient has a high probability, 64%, of having favorable pathology at radical prostatectomy. Again, you could argue whether it was indicated or not. We were grasping for straws on this particular gentleman. He was, by our radiation oncologist, he was not felt to be a good candidate for radiotherapy because of his age, his body habitus, and again, the fact that he wanted to conceive. And this is an active case, but I have follow-up PSAs that I'd be glad to share as well.
Yeah, can you tell us?
So his first visit at our institution was in May of 2009, where our first PSA was 6.0, and we just saw him in June, and his PSA was up to 8.2. Unfortunately, he has not conceived, and he has not lost weight. In fact, he's up to 115.7 kilos with a BMI of 42.4. And his best fit doubling time based on a log transformation is a PSA doubling time of 2.74 years or 33 months. Based on, we had six PSA values between May of 2009 and June of 2010. So according to what this one internet site on PSA doubling time, it says without treatment, the PSA could reach the life-threatening level of 4,000 in the year 2035, or within the interval of 2027 to 2056. So that was very helpful. And if Dr. Smith is correct, this guy will be long dead of other comorbidities before he reaches that life-threatening PSA level of 4,000. But in all seriousness, we're still trying to conceive a baby, still obese, but we're a little bit nervous about the PSA continuing to go up. And he was referred to a robotic prostatectomy specialist, but was at least not felt to be an ideal candidate for that. Even though you can do it, the weight and the fat, you will have to put this man into an extreme Trendelenburg position to get the obesity out of the way, and he may get into respiratory issues. And on top of that, this obesity may preclude a proper nerve-sparing technique, even with the robotics.
Can you go back through the technology of the RN Prostate PX study and what data we have on it right now?
Well, my understanding of it is, number one, I'm impressed with someone trying to get us to a better level in prostate cancer, to try to get us some kind of biomarkers that make us comparable to breast cancer. And so Arian Laboratory was started by a group of physicians and scientists from Memorial Sloan Kettering. The premise is that they're using a multiplex platform. There's somewhat of a black box technology in that it is proprietary, but they're doing a number of biomarkers, including Ki-67, androgen receptor, looking at pattern recognition, and it does spit out a report and a score based on clinical factors and these biomarker factors. Steve may want to comment on the research that we've conducted.
Yeah, so exactly as Judd said, it's those two, and you also have alpha-methyl-acyl-CoA racemase, AMICAR, is three markers. They look at it, and they look at expression levels using immunofluorescence. They look at glandular architecture and really quantify it. And intuitively, to me, just what they're doing with the glandular architecture is almost quantifying your Gleason score. So rather than, that looks like a small gland, that looks like a fused gland, they're actually getting the exact diameter of those glands and using at the distance from that to the next gland. So it's just quantifying what I think we're doing with the eye. Plus you have these new markers. So intuitively to me, it makes sense it should be better. Then the question is, where are the data actually to support that? And so this has been looked at now in a couple of publications. The most recent was a multi-center study in the journal Urology, of which the Durham VA participated in, and showed that it does add some information to the standard Catan nomogram. And we're still trying to look at that and look at some subsets analysis to see where it might actually be helpful. I think the other thing is their definition disease progression is actually castrate-resistant disease progression. It's not just PSA recurrence. So the 8-year, 10% was castrate-resistant definition or metastases. So they went for a more, what they thought was more clinically hard endpoint than just a little bit of rising PSA.
And, you know, because you mentioned breast cancer, and we're starting to see kind of criteria beginning to evolve, started a lot in breast cancer, looking at colon and other tumors now, for these types of markers and sort of the quality of the research and how they go about doing it. And, you know, there they've actually gone back and plugged it into randomized trials. So even though it's sort of retrospective, in a way it is prospective. What, in terms of this assay and other assays or prognosis, is happening in terms of prostate cancer?
Yeah, I mean, I think prostate cancer, and this is something I think we're ahead of the curve on the one hand, which is a good thing, but it is handicapping us on the other, and that's PSA. And PSA is a pretty good marker of disease biology prognosis. So when you look at a Catan-esque nomogram that's based upon just your stage, your Gleason score, your PSA, maybe how many cores involved, that's pretty accurate. I mean, most models will put that somewhere in the 70% accurate range for predicting who's going to progress. So now you're coming along and say, well, we want to do these molecular markers. Can we improve upon that? It's actually a pretty high bar. And a lot of these are looking at it, and I think that's ultimately where you need to get to, is to show that you can do better than what we can do without the markers. And I'm not sure anything has consistently been shown that at this point.
Any other comments on this, Judd? Do you think this is going to end up in prime time?
It's a great question. I think that the greatest need, in my opinion, well, there's a bunch of great needs, but one of the greatest needs is trying to come up with biomarkers to help us select patients for active surveillance. And obviously, in this particular case, we were attempting to use this test to reassure us that we might be in a safe mode. Again, the problem why I say it was off-label is that their data set is radical prostatectomy and recurrence after radical prostatectomy. And so what I think they need to do is validate this test in an active surveillance population. Perhaps they could go back and get the microscope slides from a series of patients who have been on active surveillance, such as the Toronto group or the Hopkins group, and at least get data in active surveillance, which they don't have. But it has tremendous potential if it can be validated in that population.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special Prostate Cancer Clinical Investigator Think Tank.